is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
At this point, when you look at some of the oligarchs themselves, I don't think money is necessarily the driving factor behind this. I think that we have to start to understand that this is ultimately about control, control of society, control of the very genetic code of the planet itself. And that might sound outlandish until you start to piece all of these different pieces of the puzzle together. Control over education, control over medicine, control over plants and agriculture start to form a control grid, which really does look like a monopolization of almost every aspect of life as we know it.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, James Corbett. Today's show, oil and 9/11, crossroads of corruption and criminality. James Corbett is the producer and host of The Corbett Report, an internet-based, independent, listener-supported alternative news source that has attracted a large audience. The Corbett Report is edited, webmastered, written, produced, and hosted by James Corbett. It includes a weekly podcast and several regular online video series. James Corbett has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started The Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. Today we discuss in detail 2-hour-long video documentaries written and produced by James Corbett, How Big Oil Conquered the World and 9/11 Trillions Follow the Money. James Corbett, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, it's nice to meet you finally, James. I'd like to talk to you today about your 2 video documentaries, How Big Oil Conquered the World and 9/11 Trillions Follow the Money. Your recent documentary, How Big Oil Conquered the World, was also called Rise of the Oligarchy. You produced it in 4 parts, The Birth of the Oligarchy, Competition is a Sin, The World in Their Image, and Monopolizing Life. You cover a breathtaking amount of complex historical events in the space of an hour and 15 minutes. And, of course, the documentary raises as many questions as it answers. Naturally, you start with the Rockefellers and move forward from there. What's an oligarchy, and why did you name it this?
I think oligarchy is the best way to try to encapsulate what really developed with the creation of the oil industry as we know it. And that, of course, dates back to the 19th century and parts of the early 20th century, but it didn't take very long for the oil industry to become monopolized. It became not just a commodity that was handled by monopoly cartels, perhaps best exemplified by the Standard Oil Cartel, but that it became the backbone for the economy and for really the entire production of world goods altogether, not only in terms of the energy that's required to produce and ship goods around the world, but even the goods themselves are often made out of petrochemical and basically their derivative products. So I thought it was important to try to understand that and the importance of that the modern oligarchy as it exists over the global economic system is in many ways an oligarchy. It is founded and run by the same family cartels that managed to monopolize the oil industry in its early parts. But I also wanted to make the point that it isn't really just the oil industry itself that is the range of influence or activity of these oligarchical interests, that over the course of the 20th century, they started to branch out into a lot of very diverse fields and used the economic control that came with the monopolization of the oil industry for other ends.
In part 2, Competition is a Sin, you cover a dizzying array of subjects, from ethanol, prohibition, the destruction of mass transit, the rise of OPEC, the elimination of the gold standard, petrodollars, etc. With regard to the so-called oil embargo of 1973, you talk about the Yom Kippur War as being orchestrated to ultimately usher in higher oil prices. I remember the 1973 oil shock, and I also remember seeing the Shah of Iran on 60 Minutes, I think it was, saying that oil tankers were leaving Iran as usual. There were also claims that these tankers were simply not being unloaded. The whole thing was fake, don't you think?
Well, yes, and I think it's important to understand where the fakeness of that event really stems from. And in the documentary, I present some of the documents that have since come to light of the 1973 meeting of the Bilderberg Group, a very elite organization that has largely remained under the media radar for many decades. It was founded in 1954 by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who himself, of course, is reputed to be one of the major stakeholders in Shell Oil, Royal Dutch Shell, that should be. And so in 1973, this Bilderberg meeting specifically was talking about the possibility of an oil crisis, a large increase in energy costs that they were talking about could be as much as a $10 to $12 increase in the price per barrel, which at that time was a 400% increase over regular prices. Now, it's interesting to note when this meeting convened in May of 1973, there was no oil embargo at that time. There was not even really the hint of one because the Yom Kippur War had not even taken place at that point. This was all theoretical that they were supposedly discussing in these leaked documents. But lo and behold, in October of that year, of course, OPEC did decide to raise oil prices, first by 70%, and then in December, the Shah of Iran, as you mentioned, demanded a 400% oil price increase at the December meeting of OPEC, and that was granted. So by the end of the year, the Bilderberg meeting that in May, again, had been calling for a 400% price increase, saw that 400% price increase materialize. And I think most interestingly, the Saudi King Faisal's personal emissary had been asked at one point by a journalist why the 400% increase was necessary, and had been told by the Shah, tell your king if he wants the answer to this question, he should go to Washington and ask Henry Kissinger, which is extremely interesting in light of recently declassified documents from the Israeli archives that were declassified in 2013 and reported on by the LA Times and other outlets at that time, that Henry Kissinger had a back-channel negotiation, a secret back-channel negotiation ongoing with Golda Meir in the run-up to the Yom Kippur War, in which Meir and Kissinger, by association, had rejected numerous different peace offerings by Sadat. And basically, the war had been, if not necessarily the invasion order signed by Henry Kissinger, at any rate, he had been complicit in the push towards that war. So that, of course, the war takes place, and then the OPEC embargo takes place as a result of that. So it does seem that we do have good, solid documentary evidence that this war was engineered, at the very least allowed to happen, or pushed into a position where it would happen, so that the OPEC oil price increase would happen. And again, we have the Saudi King's personal emissary saying that Kissinger was really responsible for the Iranian demand for the oil price increase.
Well, yeah, James, it sounds like everybody was in on it, including OPEC.
Well, exactly. Well, certain members of OPEC anyway. And of course, it did work out extremely well for certain members of the oil cartel in various parts of the world, including Saudi Arabia, who, as the other shoe of to drop in this changeover that took place in that period of time, became a beneficiary of the American military umbrella as part of the petrodollar system that was also engineered with the help of course, Henry Kissinger, who basically provided military protection as well as arms sales to Saudi Arabia in return for the Saudis agreeing to price all of their future oil sales in U.S. dollars, thus creating a demand for U.S. dollars in an environment where there was not necessarily anything really at all backing up the U.S. dollar anymore, since Kissinger had taken the dollar off of the gold standard in 1971. So if the Saudis and others who would obviously follow them in this move priced their oil in U.S. dollars, that would create that ready-made demand. And, of course, also the Saudis agreed to funnel that money back into the U.S. through the Wall Street banks by buying up U.S. treasuries. So it was a really masterful political and economic move that helped to not only consolidate the control of really the oligarchs, because, of course, this is oil interests that are now backing up the U.S. dollar and thus the world monetary system as a whole, but also, of course, for the very few elite-connected individuals and parties that get to take advantage of that new paradigm.
Well, yes, exactly. And all of these things, the going off the gold standard, the creation of the petrodollars, et cetera, this all served to preserve the dollar as the global reserve currency, right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah, because I remember from your documentary, and of course, well, it's well known, that around the time that Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard, there was an economic crisis that caused that, right?
Well, there was a number of reasons for it, and I think it was pretty inevitable by the point that Nixon actually formally took the dollar off the gold standard in 1971. It was almost inevitable that that was going to happen. There were a number of reasons for it, but really throughout the 1960s, the Bretton Woods system that had been put in place in the wake of World War II. Bretton Woods conference took place, of course, in New Hampshire in 1944 to form the basis of the post-World War II economy. And at that point, it was agreed that basically the currencies of many different countries would be pegged to the U.S. dollar, which itself would be redeemable for gold at the rate of $35 an ounce. But in order to maintain that peg, there, of course, had to be a somewhat steady and predictable increase in the supply of U.S. dollars at a reasonable rate. But as we can see, of course, with the Vietnam War, there was just increase in spending to a degree that was worrying a lot of people. And so you started to get countries like Germany and France starting to demand actual gold for their dollars. And the U.S. Federal Reserve was running out of gold reserves in order to actually backstop that. So in 1971, Nixon did end that system formally. And at that time, it really did create a system where you had this structure where all of these different currencies were more or less either pegged or working in concert with the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency, but there was really nothing at all behind it at that point. So there had to be something to backstop that, and ultimately it became the oil petrochemical industry that ended up backstopping it really at the barrel of the U.S. Military gun as encapsulated in that deal with Saudi Arabia.
Right. And of course, as I mentioned before, leading up to this point in your documentary, you go through a lot of the early history of oil monopolies, the elimination of ethanol as a fuel, actually prohibition adding to the popularity of oil, the destruction of mass transit. We all know about the electric cars. They were eliminated, et cetera, et cetera. And then in part three, The World in Their Image, you cover control of modern education, medicine, the monetary system, and the food supply. You begin with modern education. What was the Rockefeller plan for modern education, and how did it differ from traditional education?
Well, traditional education in the United States specifically, until the 1850s, there were no compulsory schooling laws. So education tended to be done locally and really in what would be seen from today's point of view as a disorganized way, but in fact led to remarkable successes in terms of having an educated and literate population. In fact, the 1840 census found that that literacy in the U.S. was upwards of 92% to 100%, which shouldn't be surprising because, of course, if you go back to revolutionary times, common sense was a remarkably popular pamphlet that really did start to turn the tide of American public opinion towards the revolutionary bent that it took and saw through to the conclusion of the creation of the country. So I think it was well known that that the American populace was extremely well educated before there was compulsory schooling.
I'm speaking with writer and producer James Corbett. Today's show, Oil and 9/11, Crossroads of Corruption and Criminality.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
But with the creation of the modern schooling system and really the Prussian education system, which was adopted largely in the late 19th century, early 20th century in America and elsewhere around the world, as John Taylor Gatto and other researchers have detailed, you started to have the possibility of the curriculum being standardized in a way that would create a predictable outcome for students. And that predictable outcome isn't really difficult to understand what it was or why it would be desired by people in industries of various sorts. Basically, they wanted not independent thinkers who were capable of thinking and acting for themselves, but really people who were educated enough to understand what was needed of them, but basically to consign themselves to a life of labor in a factory, which, of course, was the predominant industrial system of the time. And we don't have to speculate about this. We have this on the record from, for example, Frederick Taylor Gates, who was appointed by Rockefeller to lead the John D. Rockefeller created General Education Board, which was Rockefeller's first major act of philanthropy, endowed with $180 million in 1902, a staggering sum of money at that time. And in a tract written in the early 1900s, Frederick Taylor Gates wrote that he said, "In our dream, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. The present educational conventions fade from our minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or science. We are not to raise up from among them authors, orators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor will we cherish even the humbler ambition to raise up from among them lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we now have ample supply." Ultimately, of course, what are they trying to raise up then? It is docile workers for the factories of these industrial monopolists. And they were remarkably successful, I think, in that endeavor. If you start to look at the educational outcomes of the rest of the century. But it's not only Rockefeller, but Rockefeller and the Carnegie Endowment worked together in the early part of the 20th century to shape the historical understanding, first in American history, and then through a number of scholarships and the creation of various educational institutions and societies, really started to shape the way that history and education was taught in the United States generally. And another aspect of that was, of course, the Flexner Report, which was released in 1910, that was an overview of the American medical education system at that time that brought about a revolution in the American medical system, which was the next sort of phase of scope of what the oligarchs were looking to try to transform.
Well, that's right. Could you explain the petrochemical interests behind modern medicine? How does modern medicine differ from medicine in the past, and what does it have to do with petrochemicals?
Well, there are different paradigms for understanding what medicine is or how it functions. And in the late 19th century, the battle lines, or if not battle lines, at least the demarcation lines had been drawn between homeopathy, naturopathy, which looked at natural herbs and other ways of trying to stimulate one's own immune response, versus the allopathy, which of course is trying to cut and burn or try to get rid of diseases in various ways. And in the late 19th century, there was an old phrase that basically one way you'll die of the cure, the other way you'll die of the disease, talking about the pretty poor results of medicine at that time. Basically, some of the grotesque types of surgeries that were done without anesthesia or other types of ways of relieving pain were excruciating and caused a lot of early deaths themselves. On the other hand, a lot of naturopaths and homeopaths didn't really have ways of dealing with a lot of illnesses. So there was this sort of uneasy tension, and there was really no regulation by the end of the late 19th century in terms of the medical industry. There was no formalized, standardized system for education, let alone the American Medical Association was only just being birthed. So there was a very scattershot approach to medicine in the early days. But that, of course, was overtaken by the creation of the American Medical Association and the Flexner Report, which, as I say, had a huge impact. It was a Carnegie-sponsored report by someone who went on to work for the Rockefeller Institute, looking at the American medical education system and how it was sloppy and how it should be standardized. And, of course, one of the ways that it ultimately became standardized was to make it a rigorous 7-year training process or more, in which doctors were trained in the use of medicines, which, conveniently enough for the oligarchs, tended to be petrochemically derived medicines. And one, I think, particularly interesting example of that, which I point out in the documentary, is Nujol, which is short for new oil, which was the name of what was marketed as a laxative. It was literally just a crude oil byproduct that was marketed by a Standard Oil subsidiary that also produced pesticides at the same location, the same factory, incidentally, that was marketed as a laxative that would cost something like 10 to 29 cents for a 6-ounce bottle. It cost a Standard Oil less than half a cent to actually create that bottle, but led to quite a lot of profit, obviously. Those are the types of direct monetary interests that the petrochemical manufacturers had in the creation of our modern conception of medicine, to the point where today medicine is synonymous with, of course, the idea of going to a doctor and getting a prescription for a medicine, usually, again, a petrochemically derived medicine, as a way of trying to cope with illness, rather than, of course, looking at ways to improve one's own immune system or to basically deal with the prevention side of medical care rather than the cure side.
What are some of the corporations involved in modern medicine, and how did they affect their control?
Well, some of the largest chemical companies in the world were, for example, BASF, which derives from a company that was founded in Germany in the early 20th century called IG Farben. And it was a drug and chemical cartel that was founded by some of the largest chemical companies in Germany at that time. And it became one of the largest industrial manufacturers in the world, in fact, only behind Standard Oil of New Jersey and a few other companies to take the largest company spot. And after World War II, IG Farben was disbanded because of its help in the rise of the Third Reich. But exactly like Standard Oil, which was broken up in the early part of the 20th century, but in fact just became an even larger corporation, really, or a series of corporations when it was disbanded, IG Farben was likewise. So BASF, of course, remains one of the largest chemical companies in the world today, as are a couple of other offshoots that I think will be well known to the audience, Bayer and Sanofi, which are some of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world. And again, this ties directly back to the oligarchical influence that we've seen with IG Farben having been not only itself a petrochemical and a company, but also one that had on its board Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who I mentioned before was part of the Royal Dutch Shell conglomerate. So again, this traces back to the same families that have been together with this petrochemical interest since the beginning. And to this day, I mean, Bayer and Sanofi remain some of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world and extremely profitable companies for those involved with them.
Let's talk about food. What is the Green Revolution, and does it differ from the Gene Revolution?
Well, yes, at least in a manner of speaking. The Green Revolution dates back to the 1940s, and it dates back to in most readings of history, it dates back to Norman Borlaug, who was a researcher who was investigating various forms of wheat and maize and other crops that were being cultivated in Mexico. And his task was to try to find crops that would be more resistant to various problems that Mexican farmers would have. And part of his research involved finding new strains, creating new strains of wheat and other crops that would be more responsive to the Mexican farmers and their plights. And he was quite successful in that. And through a variety of techniques, he was able to breed new strains of wheat, for example, that were much more resilient and provide a lot greater crops yield. And as a result of that, and the application of his various techniques in various places around the world, we had what is called the Green Revolution, basically an enormous increase in yields that took place throughout the 1950s and 60s and 70s that was enabled by this revolution through these modified strains, but also through the introduction of modern industrial farming techniques. And of course, as it turns out, Norman Borlaug was a researcher for the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and associated interests in a number of petrochemical and associated companies started to fund to the tune of billions of dollars the cultivation of these crops in various third world countries. And of course, also attendant with it, the creation of the modern agribusiness cartels, including the ABCD Seed Cartel, Archer Daniel Midland, Bunge, Cargill, Louis Dreyfus. Some of these companies really started to consolidate control over world food supplies at that time, and continue to in the present day. And of course, this was again directly beneficial to the oligarchs themselves, who, of course, as one of their petrochemical derivatives is petrochemically derived fertilizers. So you had fertilizer companies like DuPont and Hercules Powder and others that were able to directly benefit from this. But then, of course, there was also the secondary or tertiary benefits of this that also accrued to the oligarchs in the form of the modern industrial practices that were being spread around the world at the same time as this Green Revolution, with fertilizers and tractors and irrigation. Of course, all of these modern farm implements running on oil and oil's supplied energy from, of course, the oligarchs themselves. And a lot of this was financed through the U.S. government, through U.S. aid programs, including President Johnson's Food for Peace program. So basically, the agribusiness giants were making direct profits from this Green Revolution via the U.S. government and ultimately the U.S. taxpayers. And in the service of this spreading of the Green Revolution around the globe. And the Green Revolution has been sold as this great success story, but there are, of course, numerous downsides that have taken place as a result of it as well. First of all, it's not at all clear that the enormous increases in yields that we saw in the middle of the 20th century were directly related to the Green Revolution itself. In fact, in India, research has shown that the pace of the crop yield increases actually started to slow after the introduction of the Green Revolution because of disparate ways that this was being applied in different areas. And it also had real social costs in a lot of places. Basically, this tended to benefit people who were rich landowners already at the expense of the farm-working peasants, who were more and more being replaced basically by automation and had to move to urban slums and try to find ways of making money, usually by ending up in third world condition sweatshop-like condition factories producing goods for multinational conglomerates. So there was a lot of downside to the Green Revolution, but it's usually talked about as some sort of great success.
I'm speaking with writer and producer James Corbett. Today's show, Oil and 9/11, Crossroads of Corruption and Criminality. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
The Green Revolution ultimately, of course, just parlayed into the Gene Revolution, which is what is the moniker for the modern, what they call the biotech tech industry revolution of the food supply, which is now looking at various ways to scientifically engineer at the genetic level various strains of different crops that will be even more resistant and supposedly require less fertilizers and other chemical inputs. Although actually research shows that genetically modified crops actually require more fertilizers than did their non-genetically modified brethren. So it, again, is a revolution that may be more hype than it is actually delivering. But at any rate, it is, of course, once again, populated by the same petrochemical interests. You have all of the IG Farben offshoots with their own biotech branches. You have Bayer Crop Science, you have BASF Plant Science, you have Dow AgroScience, you have DuPont Biotechnology, and a lot of other related firms with oligarchical interests. But on top of that, you have a dizzying array of different research institutes and societies that have been created directly through Rockefeller or Rockefeller-associated money in the past few decades to try to spread this gene revolution. There's the International Rice Research Institute, which, of course, is Rockefeller-funded. You have the International Service for the Acquisition of Agrobiotech Applications, which is a Rockefeller/Monsanto/USAID conglomerate. You have the Consultative Group of International Agriculture Research, which was created by the World Bank in association with the Rockefeller and Ford Foundations. So a lot of these same monies are accruing to this gene revolution, which is really just a furtherance of the green revolution, and in many ways represents a really worrying monopolization of the building blocks of life itself when you start looking at the ways that the gene revolution relies on these genetically modified crops, which are patented and patentable, and these companies are not afraid to use them. In fact, they already have in numerous locations used the philanthropic cover to introduce these genetically modified strains in the midst of severe droughts and other problems with harvests, and then actually gone and tried to sue farmers or entire countries, in fact, that were trying to use these products, these genetically modified products, without paying the proper royalties. In fact, that's exactly what happened in Argentina, where Monsanto did exactly that and ended up trying to demand royalties from Argentina farmers for planting their crops. So this is, again, going on, and it represents not only billions upon billions upon billions of dollars for the companies involved in these biotech conglomerates, but, of course, also, again, a worrying consolidation of control of the seed supply itself in the hands of very few companies.
Well, that's right. In addition to that, of course, the very big questions about the health effects for people who eat these genetically modified foods. That's a whole other subject as well. As you point out, funding of the gene revolution is provided by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and other such organizations. What is the ultimate goal of all of this control?
Well, this is really, I think, the important thing for people to grasp. Once again, I don't think that ultimately the monetary incentive is the only one at work here. I think that's the easily understandable one. And of course, there are, as I say, there are numerous corporations that are making billions upon billions of dollars through this spreading of this green slash gene revolution around the world. But I think it's at this point, when you look at some of the oligarchs themselves, I don't think money is necessarily the driving factor behind this. I think that we have to start to understand that this is ultimately about control of society, control of the very genetic code of the planet itself. And that might sound outlandish until you start to piece all of these different pieces of the puzzle together. Control over education, control over medicine, control over plants and agriculture start to form a control grid which really does look like a monopolization of almost every aspect of life as we know it. And the question is there an ideology behind this, an ideology driving it? And the answer is a resounding yes. And in fact, that is exactly what I'm going to get into in the follow-up to this documentary, which I hope to have released in the next month or two, which will be looking at the ideology of control that is really driving the oligarchs. And it has its roots in late 19th century development of the pseudoscience, the now discredited pseudoscience of eugenics, that was largely funded and helped by, of course, the Rockefellers in the American context through American research centers like the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory and the American Eugenics Society, and around the world, including, of course, in Germany through the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, and how that eugenics idea, which is basically the idea that there are certain people who are just genetically superior to others and thus have a sort of modern scientific divine right to rule. It's the modern scientific gloss on that. And that ultimately was parlayed into a type of crypto-eugenics after World War II and the discrediting of eugenics as pseudoscience, which took on the form of overpopulation fear-mongering and has really taken on the form, the guise of concern about climate. And I think that's going to be the next way in which this agenda of control is being foisted on the public.
Well, as you say in your part four, conclusion, monopolizing life, you say that the aim was much greater than a mere oil monopoly. It was the quest to monopolize all aspects of life. And I think you've just laid that out pretty clearly. I'm very much looking forward to the second installment of these documentaries. I'll have to hand it to you for putting these things together. This must entail an awful lot of work on your part.
It is an incredible amount of work. I guess I have the advantage that I've now been researching these subjects for the last 10 years, and so I've accrued an awful lot of information. The real hardest part of it is trying to distill it down to an hour and 15 minutes and have it make sense. I think you'll find in my podcast archives, I've talked about a lot of these subjects before, maybe not some of these details, but these subjects, broadly speaking, I've talked about at great length in many, many different hours of many different podcasts. But trying to distill it down is the hardest part. So really, the writing of this this transcript took about a month and a half to put together. And of course, there was about a month of video editing that my video editor did an excellent job of putting this together. But really, it does represent the culmination of upwards of a decade of research.
Well, I'm not surprised to hear that. And of course, when I was watching your hour and 15 minute documentary, whoa, I had to keep stopping and thinking because it goes by very quickly. And as I said before, and you've reiterated, it covers a vast amount of subjects, very complex. James, I'd like to now talk about another documentary that you made on 9/11. In your documentary, 9/11 Trillions, Follow the Money, an investigation of the 9/11 money trail, you begin with the question, what was 9/11? A terrorist atrocity? An attack on America? The first salvo in a new war? A day that changed everything? Well, that's a very good question. What was 9/11 in your opinion?
I think first and foremost, we have to understand 9/11 as a crime. And I don't think this is just a matter of semantics. I think it's extremely important the way that we approach 9/11, what it was, in order to determine how we should approach understanding it, trying to piece it together and understand what happened. If we take it as an act of war, a terrorist atrocity, if we just immediately start to do that, we put it into a framework where we have already assumed the conclusion. We know who is behind it, we know what it was done for, and we know how to respond. And that's, of course, exactly what took place. And we saw we're still living through all of the various ramifications of that, including not only, of course, the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, still ongoing to this day, but, of course, ultimately the invasion of Iraq, which was largely predicated on the fear that was induced on 9/11. And we are still, obviously, with ISIS, living through the ramifications of that. So I think it's extremely important to understand that 9/11 essentially was a crime. It was a crime perpetrated by, there have been the people identified by the 9/11 Commission as the 19 hijackers, but more importantly, crimes do not take place, generally speaking, or certainly not crimes of this magnitude, just by a few individuals just deciding to get on a plane one day. There is a conspiracy behind them, necessarily, by definition. If they have conspired to bring this about, there is a conspiracy. So I think we have to try to understand that. And of course, when we look at it as a crime, one of the key investigative tools for any would-be investigator of any crime is follow the money. This is a dictum that is well known because it does tend to work. We can understand the connections. We can start to piece together how the crime was committed and why it was committed if we start to look at the various ways that it was funded and the ramifications of this. What kind of monetary effects did this have? And I think when we put 9/11 in that context, we have a vastly different story going on than what we've been presented with in the news media as the official story of 9/11.
You begin your documentary on 9/11 with the heist. You state that in 1998, the New York, New Jersey Port Authority decided to privatize the World Trade Center complex, and that in April of 2001, an agreement was reached with a consortium of investors led by Silverstein Properties, and that in July of 2001, a 99-year lease was signed with Larry Silverstein. How was this deal unusual?
Well, there were a few things that were unusual about it, one of which was that the Port Authority had only insured the WTC Center for $1.5 billion. And in fact, earlier, I believe earlier in 2001, the entire complex had been estimated at a value of $1.2 billion. And yet Silverstein insisted on insuring $3.55 billion, which is a doubling of the amount of insurance that the Port Authority had on it, which, again, is somewhat unusual. And in fact, was such a large deal that it was very difficult to put together. Silverstein's insurance broker ultimately had to split the coverage up amongst 25 different dealers. It was a very complex negotiation that was still ongoing as September 11th unfolded. There was preliminary agreements in place, but it had not all been finalized, which led to the years and years of court battles that we saw in the years afterwards, with Silverstein being embroiled in all sorts of court actions against his insurers, trying to claim not only, of course, the $3.55 billion that the World Trade Center had been insured for under that deal, but in fact, $7.1 billion, because as he immediately in the wake of 9/11 tried to claim, this was not one but two acts of terrorism and thus counted double for the insurance purposes. So that was fairly unusual. Also, just the fact that this was a 99-year lease that specifically included provisions in the event of the destruction of the towers that would allow Silverstein Properties to rebuild in that area and to increase the amount of commercial space available in that area, which is interesting because, of course, prior to 9/11, the World Trade Center was not a prime real estate property. It was not fully leased. It was, in fact, an aging building that had many problems, or aging buildings that had many problems with them, including asbestos problems that were going to require a large amount of money to solve. And in fact, they were not a particularly, other than the prestige associated, of course, with being the leaseholder of the World Trade Center, there were a lot of problems with the buildings themselves. Well, that seemed to have been taken care of, I suppose, in just literally weeks after the ink was dry on that deal.
I'm speaking with writer and producer James Corbett. Today's show, Oil and 9/11, Crossroads of Corruption and Criminality. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Is it also true that Larry Silverstein took out insurance against a terrorist attack?
Terrorist events were part of the coverage. My understanding is that that was not in and of itself unusual. Of course, his trying to make the two plane strikes count for two different terror attacks was somewhat beyond the pale. But he ultimately did end up making over $4 billion in insurance coverage, and he had only insured for $3.55 billion. So the courts ultimately handed him something of a victory in that regard. And ultimately, he did profit from the attacks directly.
You say that a much deeper, more complex, and well-hidden heist was taking place behind closed doors on September 11th, 2001. What can you tell us about this deeper heist? First of all, what is Marsh & McLennan?
Marsh & McLennan builds itself as a diversified risk insurance and professional services firm, ultimately a type of insurance agent, that currently has over 57,000 employees and brings in revenues of over $13 billion every year. At the time of 9/11, they occupied floors 93 to 100 in the North Tower of the World Trade Center, and they had hundreds of employees working there. And this is important because Marsh had recently, just prior to the attacks, contracted with a firm called Silverstream Software to try to create an electronic connection between Marsh and some of its premier clients for paperless transactions. Nothing of this sort had been accomplished or even attempted before this point, and so they were really trying to pioneer something with this. So some of their largest clients included Merrill Lynch and Deutsche Bank and Bankers Trust and Alex Brown, Morgan Stanley, and other financial services firms that were contracting with Marsh. And so they were creating this special proprietary electronic paperless transaction software system. And in fact, they ultimately ended up winning a type of industry, insurance industry insider kind of award called the Accord Award, I believe in 2001, specifically for developing that system shortly before the 9/11 attacks. And this software, the extent of it is not really publicly known, but we do have one person who is working on that deal as a sales representative for Silverstream who has come out and talked about the deal itself. And his name is Richard Grove. He now has his own podcast and runs his own website at tragedyandhope.com. But he was part of this deal as a sales representative who started to notice anomalies in the way that this contract was being billed. And basically, to the tune of millions of dollars, money was being put into this deal that wasn't making its way through the system properly. And he was trying to sort this out with various people, both at Silverstream and at Marsh and at Marsh's clients. And this started to become a major issue. And ultimately, on 9/11 itself, there was a meeting that was taking place that we do have independent confirmation that this took place from Marsh's chief information officer, Ellen Clark, in a 2006 interview. There was a meeting that was taking place in Marsh's offices in the World Trade Center on 9/11 that was specifically going to hear about these suspicious parts of this contract that was taking place. Now, obviously, in the North Tower on 9/11, where this conference call was taking place, none of the employees involved in that conference call survived. Richard Grove, who was stuck in traffic on the way to the World Trade Center, as he was supposed to make an appearance at that conference call, ultimately didn't make it there and survived to tell the tale. Now, the interesting part of this comes in the wake of 9/11, when there was a German company called Convar Infosys that was hired to try to recover some of the information from the hard drives at the World Trade Center. And there was quite a bit of coverage about this in December of 2001, including a Reuters article, and Fox News, I believe, covered it, CNN, talking about the investigation that Convar was involved in trying to recover this information from the damaged hard drives. And as a representative of Convar at that time, Peter Herschel talked about, they started to find a large number of anomalous and unexplained transactions in the immediate lead up to and during the attacks themselves on 9/11. And he, Peter Herschel, the Convar's director, said, the suspicion is that inside information about the attack was used to send financial transaction commands and authorizations in the belief that amid all the chaos, the criminals would have, at the very least, a good head start. And this is interesting because we also have from Michael Rupert, who I believe you've talked to in the past, one of the former Deutsche Bank employees who was working in the World Trade Center at that time, talked to him about how the computer systems in Deutsche Bank in the Twin Towers were being, quote unquote, taken over, co-opted and run by something. They didn't know where it was coming from. There was a massive data purge, a massive data download as the attacks were happening. And of course, all of this swirls around the E-Link clients that Silverstream Software was developing with Marsh for its key contractors. So all of this seems to indicate, and again, Convar did start to find hard data backing up the fact that there were anomalous transactions taking place in the World Trade Center at the time of 9/11. But interestingly enough, that Convar investigation was ultimately quashed, and the FBI will no longer talk about it. Convar itself will no longer talk about it. They will not even confirm that they ever did this work, although they do talk about it in promotional materials. When asked by interviewers about the information, what they found, what kind of transactions they were looking at, how much, they will now not talk about it at all, simply saying that that investigation was over and they're not allowed to talk about it anymore. We do know that the FBI was one of the investigative agencies that was getting information from this, but they have not released any reports on what was found in the Convar information. So we know that there was anomalous transactions taking place. We know that there was this unusual, unprecedented e-link that was being forged in the months prior to 9/11 between Marsh and McLennan and its various contractors. And we have testimony from a Deutsche Bank employee that there was something very anomalous happening during the attacks themselves. But we don't really have ultimately any answer as to what this all was, because unfortunately, again, all of these investigations have been quashed and come to an end.
Now, did Richard Grove work for Silverstream or for Marsh?
He was working for Silverstream Software, specifically as a sales representative. He was selling the software that Silverstream was developing to Marsh so that Marsh could develop this e-link software.
I see. And yes, you mentioned Michael Rupert. Just as an aside, the first program that I ever produced on Guns and Butter was actually a little half-hour program live with Mike Rupert 1 month after 9/11. It was going to be an economic show on the put options, and of course it turned into a show on 9/11. And so I've found this subject following me around ever since. What did you discover in your research about insider trading in the days leading up to and on September 11th?
Well, as you say, Michael Rupert did do pioneering work on this issue, and it's one that's somewhat understood by, I think, a lot of the public at this point, but really only in a tiny little way. A lot of people have heard about the put options that were put on various airlines, the American Airlines and United Airlines, that were, of course, obviously adversely affected by 9/11. And that is a part of the story. And it was one that was well covered in the first couple of months after 9/11, even in mainstream locations. ABC News and others covered it, talking about some of these put options. And to put it into perspective, for example, you have put options on United Airlines that were put in the days prior to 9/11 that were relatively small, $180,000. But in the wake of 9/11 and, of course, the plunging of United Airlines stocks, that turns into $2.4 million. So millions of dollars of benefits. And that's just one example of one of the trades that was made. And I think the impression that a lot of people have is that, well, this was investigated and they found that there was really nothing behind it and it's been overhyped. Quite the contrary. In fact, there have been three different scientific studies that have taken place over the past 10 years that have demonstrated that there is a statistically identifiable increase in put option activity, unusual increase in option activity in the S&P and Dow Jones in lead up to 9/11 that are suggestive of advanced knowledge of the attacks. And it isn't just airlines. There was a number of put options on a number of companies that were directly impacted by 9/11, including Boeing, Merrill Lynch, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Munich Re, the AXA Group. Marsh & McLennan was one of the major companies that were implicated in this options trading. But also on the other side, not just put options, but call options, i.e. basically bets that the stock was going to increase, were also put in an anomalous way on Raytheon stock, which at the time was $25. Of course, after the invasion of Afghanistan, which was heavily supplied by Raytheon Tomahawk missiles, that stock went up to $34, a 37% increase. So again, there was a lot of different trades made on a lot of different stocks in the immediate run-up to 9/11. We're talking days and weeks prior to 9/11 that ultimately ended up paying millions and millions of dollars. The official investigation of this by the FBI ultimately concluded that we have not developed any evidence suggesting that those who had advanced knowledge of the September 11th attacks traded on the basis of that information, which seems to be, at first glance, a denial that there had been any advanced trading taking place. But in fact, when you look at that, they say that there is no evidence suggesting that those who had advanced knowledge traded on the basis of that information, which of course begs the question, how did the FBI, how did the Department of the Treasury, how did the SEC determine who had advanced knowledge of the attacks, especially when there seems to be advanced knowledge in the very act of placing these bets themselves? And that question is begged even more when you look at some of the leads that were deliberately not followed up by the FBI. For example, a briefing document from the FBI in 2003 that was declassified in 2009 identified a couple of individuals who, for example, had purchased 56,000 shares of Stratesec stock in the days prior to 9/11, stock that did go up. They provide security systems to airports, which of course saw an increase in revenues in the wake of 9/11 and the increased security procedures that were implemented. Incidentally, they were also in charge of security at Dulles and World Trade Center and United Airlines, so they were also implicated in the quote-unquote failure of 9/11, but their stock did go up. So this purchase of 56,000 shares in the days prior to 9/11 was of interest, but the FBI decided not to even interview the people who had bought these stocks because the investigation found that they revealed no ties to terrorism or other negative information. And Kevin Ryan, who I believe you've also interviewed on this program, has talked about how that was ultimately, it was Wirt Dexter Walker III, a distant relative of George W. Bush, President Bush, but also a business partner of Marvin Bush, the president's brother. So these were a couple of the people who were identified in that FBI investigation and not even interviewed because they had no conceivable ties to terrorism. Therefore, they could not have been trading on advanced knowledge. So I think that goes to show that the FBI investigation was ultimately an open question itself. How did they know that these people had no advanced knowledge?
Visit gunsandbutter.org to hear the remainder of this interview and read a transcript. James Corbett, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over.
I've been speaking with James Corbett. Today's show has been Oil and 9/11, Crossroads of Corruption and Criminality. James Corbett is the producer and host of The Corbett Report, an internet-based, independent, listener-supported alternative news source that has attracted a large audience. The Corbett Report is edited, webmastered, written, produced, and hosted by James Corbett. It includes a weekly podcast and several regular online video series. James Corbett has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent, critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He is also an editorial writer for the International Forecaster, the weekly e-newsletter created by the late Bob Chapman. Visit the Corbett Report website at corbettreport.com. That's CORBETT report.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This installment is mostly a personal essay. It's a meditation on motorcycles and motorcycling, and on trying to escape from corporate plastic and searching for authenticity. Sure, I'm just rewriting Catcher in the Rye. Only this time, Holden Caulfield is in his early 60s, and he's riding a Harley Road King. I hope you'll stay tuned. At my age, I find I have a couple fewer vices than I used to. I don't drink anymore, don't gamble, never smoked, and apparently Connecticut always had a severe scarcity of loose women, especially in my neighborhood. How I miss Pittsburgh in the 1970s. I have sloth, of course, but I don't even know if sloth is considered a vice. Maybe it's just one of the seven deadly sins. I don't know. I wasn't brought up a Catholic. The Methodist Church didn't have deadly sins back then, though I believe they did practice all the vices religiously. One vice I do have is burning more gasoline than necessary. I've owned one motorcycle or another for 40 years. Sure, I commute to work on my motorcycle more often than not, but I also ride it a lot for psychotherapy, or just for pleasure. It would be more responsible to ride my bicycle instead, and better for my cholesterol, to say nothing of the ozone layer. Well, at least I do feel guilty about all the unnecessary internal combustion I'm setting off. Now, motorcycling leads me to a lot of thoughts about the genuine and the fake, about human values versus corporate values, and about authenticity versus plastic. I like the concept plastic in its late 1960s sense of phony, fake, artificial in the worst sense of the word. Like the old song by the Mothers of Invention, Plastic People. There's almost a glut of highly verbal motorcyclists expressing similar thoughts. Robert M. Pirsig went down this path before I did. He wrote a surprisingly popular book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Remember that? Came out in 1974, and I think it's still in print. In that book, Pirsig spent a lot of time, and words, reflecting on the nature of quality with a capital Q. I never did figure out exactly what his meaning was here. He had done graduate work at the University of Chicago, and it showed. But my sense is that he was definitely on the right track. His search for capital Q quality was much like my search for authenticity. Both terms are opposites of plastic. And both his search and mine involved riding around on a motorcycle. And before that, there was Holden Caulfield, sick and tired of phoniness. Probably The Catcher in the Rye would be a better book if Holden had bought a motorcycle. His mother would never have let him, of course. Nor would my mother. To her dying day, Mom hoped I would get rid of the motorcycle before I killed myself. I might prove her right some day. Mom was a generous and loving woman. If I do prove her right some day and kill myself on a motorcycle, I'm sure she will have the grace not to say, "I told you so." A lot of motorcycles today are extremely complex machines, and they look it. They have complicated computer control of engine parameters, moment-by-moment automatic suspension adjustment, traction control, anti-lock brakes, GPS, Sirius satellite radio, and Bluetooth everything, with looks to match. Odd, cluttered, asymmetrical shapes with weird edges and intersections. Intrusive, unusual shapes for everything. They looked like some Rube Goldberg contraption that's been run through a trash compactor. I've always been attracted to simpler design, simple, clean lines, and the minimum of bells and whistles. For the past 13 years, I've had the same motorcycle, a Harley-Davidson model called the Road King. This is an old-fashioned-looking Harley. Looks like an Electroglide police bike from 1965. Big, clear windshield in front, fiberglass saddlebags in back. Air-cooled V-twin engine. No tachometer needed, just a big round speedometer on top of the gas tank. My machine even has a carburetor. No fancy fuel injection for the likes of me. I think I got the last one. Not even Harley uses carburetors anymore. Harley-Davidson Motor Company spent a huge amount of time and money in making this antiquated motorcycle design work well by today's standards. And it does work well. It's been very reliable, apart from one breakdown at age 12, and it has never leaked a drop of oil. When it comes to top speed or acceleration or pure horsepower, many motorcycles will top the Road King. But the Road King has a certain elegance of form and function, an elegance that's hard to explain. It's got enough power, and it's quiet. The self-canceling turn signals work very well. That's actually very hard to design for a motorcycle. The clutch engages beautifully. The carburation is excellent. No stumbles or lurches at any throttle opening. The gearbox shifts loudly but precisely. The saddlebags are large and quite waterproof. The gas mileage is fairly decent, 40 miles per gallon on the blue highways, less on the interstate. The saddle is comfortable for hours at a time. Add a passenger and the bike still handles well. The big headlight and spotlights light up the road very nicely. Even in cold weather, the big engine starts right up. The bike is heavy, but it's not top-heavy. The weight is carried fairly low. And everywhere, the Road King's lines are clean, simple, and mostly organic. If you just drive a car, you might take all these virtues for granted, but finding all of them in a motorcycle is rare. The bike's quiet virtues are Harley-Davidson's dark secrets. The company's overactive marketing department has never said a word about any of the bike's real virtues. Marketing prefers to spin fantasies about rugged individualism and lifestyle and hipness and thunder and machismo and the high-tech gigas on a few top-of-the-line models, not the Road King, fortunately. Gigas like the multimedia infotainment system with its 6-inch color display on the dashboard. Thanks, but no thanks. I'll keep the good saddlebags and the good headlight and the motor that starts right up on winter mornings, though. New England's back roads and small towns are all the infotainment system I need. Plus, maybe a good road atlas staying nice and dry in the right saddlebag. I don't want to endorse any particular brand of motorcycle. You could also buy a very nice Honda motorcycle, or BMW, or Triumph, or Kawasaki. And now they've even resurrected Indian. Indian was a grand American brand a century ago. They were made just upstream from me in Springfield, Massachusetts. Indian was Harley-Davidson's chief competitor until the 1950s, when Indian went out of business. Since then, a couple failed attempts were made to revive the brand, but the current attempt looks like it's working. Polaris, the jet ski and snowmobile people. Polaris owns Indian now, so the owners have some capital and some good engineers on the payroll, and even some experience making motorcycles. I wish them well. Interestingly, I haven't heard any complaints about racist brand names with Indian. To my ears, Indian Motorcycles doesn't sound a whole lot different from Washington Redskins. And the company is rubbing it on thick, resurrecting also its old model names like Chief and Scout. At least the new company isn't calling its factory the Wigwam. The original company did. That's what they called the Springfield Works, the Wigwam. Sheesh. Actually, I don't mean to talk about motorcycles all day. That's just a preface. I mean to talk about authenticity. But if you're out looking for authenticity, a motorcycle is as good a vehicle as any to search for it. And a Harley Road King isn't a bad choice. Other vehicles could work. Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters used an old school bus. William Least Heat Moon used a van. That was in his book Blue Highways. On a Rand McNally map, the blue highways are the back roads, the numbered state routes. That's what you want to drive down. Me too. And then there was Simon and Garfunkel's song America. Here, the narrator and his girlfriend set out on a Greyhound bus. Do you remember that song, America? There's one line in it that makes me want to cry every time I hear it. It's done this, like, for 30 years. I don't even know why. It goes, Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I knew she was sleeping.
Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I knew she was sleeping. I'm empty and aching and I don't know why. Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for a man.
Why that line always chokes me up is one of life's little mysteries. Beats me. Probably because I felt the same. Lost and empty and aching and I don't know why. I once even had a girlfriend named Kathy. I may even have boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh. That was another line from the song. But I digress. Anyway, for them it was a Greyhound bus. For me, as for Robert Pirsig, a motorcycle. For Wyatt and Billy in the film Easy Rider, it was a motorcycle. And for many others, too, it was a motorcycle. A lot of pop music involves motorcycles. Sometimes it's a means of escape, as in Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. Sometimes it's a means of rebellion, as in Steppenwolf's Born to Be Wild. Or maybe it's just for pleasure, as in Arlo Guthrie's motorcycle song. We won't even mention the Shangri-La's Leader of the Pack.
He's so small. He kissed me goodbye. The tears were beginning to show. As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. And what he heard, I'll never know.
But once in a while, in music, it's a quest like mine. Get away from the fake and the plastic. Get away from fashion and the mind games played by the sophisticates. Get out into the country. Get in touch with a lifestyle older and smaller and slower and more personal. Someplace where you don't have to carry a smartphone or an infotainment center to feel connected. Is life in the provinces more authentic than it is in the suburbs? Hard to say, but it looks like it to an outsider. For sure, life in the provinces is less corporate-controlled, at least on the surface. Of course, the corporation still owns the factory where everybody works, and which they're in the process of shutting down. But the local culture is less run by and for corporate marketing departments. Downtown is not just a commercial strip choked with franchises, accessible only by car. Even as hip and urban a guy as Lou Reed sang about firing up his Kawasaki GPZ, getting the heck out of town, and putting the kickstand down in rural Pennsylvania. That's in his song New Sensations, released in 1984. That's just a couple of years after William Least Heat Moon published his tale of traveling the blue highways. Back then, I myself didn't have to escape to anywhere. I was already there in eastern Iowa. But now I understand what he's saying. Here's a bit of Lou Reed.
I took my GPZ out for a ride. The engine felt good between my thighs. The air felt cold, it was 40 degrees outside. I rode to Pennsylvania near the Delaware Gap. Sometimes I got lost and had to check the map. I stopped at a roadside diner for a burger and a Coke. There were some country folk and some hunters inside. Somebody got themselves married and somebody died. I went to the jukebox and played a hillbilly song. They was arguing about football as I waved and went outside. And I headed for the mountains, feeling warm inside. I love that GPC so much, you know, that I could kiss her.
I thought of Lou Reed's song as I was riding the motorcycle home just last Friday. I had had reason to ride to the town of Montville in southeastern Connecticut. Not a very good reason, but there I was. When I finished my business there, I was hungry. After some internal debate, I stopped at a somewhat grungy-looking little diner I had noticed on the edge of town. Mel's Diner, on a genuine blue highway, Connecticut Route 163. 163 here was an urban street in a small, old mill town. Exactly what mill town this particular spot was is a matter of discussion. Between the cook's explanation and later Wikipedia, I think I figured it out. You could play it safe and say the diner is in Montville. Montville covers a lot of ground, including the spot where the diner stands. Most people, though, would say Uncasville. That's the name the post office uses. Technically, Uncasville is a village within the town of Montville. However, the diner probably is actually in Palmertown, which is a different village within the town of Montville. Palmertown is where the map says we are. However, the term Palmertown is no longer in common use, except among some old people, the cook told me, So why don't you just say Uncasville? Logically, Uncasville is the least correct of the three possible names, but that's the best one to use if you actually want people to understand where you're talking about. I guess I've been living in New England too long, because this all made perfect sense. 30 years ago, I would have thought I had taken a wrong turn off Route 82 and ended up in the Twilight Zone. But by now, it all seemed perfectly sensible. I don't claim to understand the Christian doctrine of the Trinity, but a lot of people around here at least claim to believe it. And if the Trinity is at least partly comprehensible to you, it should be just a snap to believe that Mel's Diner is in Montville and Uncasville and Palmertown. The Mohegan Indians have a resort casino in the area, which they too say is in Uncasville, even though the casino is even further away from Uncasville than Mel's Diner is. There's just something magical about that name that makes everyone want to say they live there. Uncasville. Of course, the Mohegans have an excuse. After all, Uncasville was named after one of their own. We'll see if any of the Mohegans decides to open up a dealership selling Indian motorcycles. I'm guessing they won't. But in the unlikely event they do, they'll probably put it in New London and say it's in Uncasville. But I digress. Back to Mel's Diner. Very small place, and as unpretentious as you can get. On the outside, it looks just a little shabby. Old asphalt shingles, and parking for just 6 cars right in front. No stainless steel, no neon except for a small sign in a window that says open. Inside you find just 6 booths and 5 small tables and 8 stools at the counter. But inside is very clean, well lighted and comfortable. Copies of the local newspaper are on the counter. A staff of 2 today, a waitress and a cook, both women about 40. No cutesy professional patter cooked up by some marketing department from either of them. The waitress didn't tell me her name and didn't ask how I am doing today. That's a good sign. Cordial enough and genuine. Just a normal, decent 40-year-old woman. Not an actress with a script to recite. The cook was more the tugboat Annie type, but also cordial. I liked them both. A young Asian family was in one booth, a teenaged couple in another. 2 workmen and I shared the counter. On one end of the room was a big corrugated box that said Christmas decorations. Hand-lettered in magic marker. Terrific. I parked my helmet, jacket, and gloves on top. The breakfast menu was small and the lunch menu smaller. My cheeseburger was large and surprisingly good. Freshly ground, the waitress said. The owner insists on it. The owner is not a corporation, but a local person, needless to say. The coffee was very good, too, much better than the usual restaurant stuff. The bill came to less than $8. A good deal. Why did I find this place so attractive? It wasn't the food, really. Certainly not the decor. Certainly not the prestige of the place, or the trendiness, or the glamour of the staff. There was just something real about the place. Real food prepared and served by real people. To customers who also are real people. All of them part of a real community, not just transients off a highway off-ramp. Mel's seemed to be part of the daily life of an actual town, even if the townsmen didn't quite agree on what the name of the town was. All part of a real town, except for me, that is. I was the transient, the interloper, though they treated me well nonetheless. The place just felt real in a way that cookie-cutter franchises never do. There must be 8,000 Dunkin' Donuts restaurant franchises in Connecticut, all identical. At least, all identical in my memory. All of them seem to have the same faceless staff, the same mediocre food, the same yellow plastic bilingual caution wet floor sign, the same dull commercial strip for a neighborhood, the same menu, every item on it focus group tested and computer controlled. Never a surprise, never an unexpected delight, never a big cardboard box that says Christmas decorations at the end of the room. I have some acquaintances who motorcycle. These particular people wouldn't dream of stopping any place but Dunkin' Donuts to take a break. Maybe McDonald's, in the unlikely event there's no Dunkin' Donuts nearby. Mel's Diner would be out of the question. Too small, too archaic, not efficient enough, not enough flavors available, bathroom too small, and the waitress isn't 17 and perky and cute. Of course, these motorcyclists don't care much for Harley-Davidsons either, and for some of the same reasons. Well, it takes all kinds. There's some new construction in my town, Manchester, just north of the downtown center. A used car lot has been demolished, and in its place they're building a new gas station convenience store. A Cumberland Farms franchise. Regardless of its bucolic name, Cumberland Farms is owned by a big oil company. Of course. The sloping roof of the new store has some nice New England-style gables, or you might call them dormer windows. Like a Cape Cod-style house has on its second floor, jutting out of its sloping roof. I saw the construction of the new store. First, they put on the sloping roof, with no gables. Then they nailed the gable on to the outside of the roof. No connection to the inside. The dormer window doesn't let any light into the building. On the other side of the window, there's nothing but the solid outside of the roof. Now, here in New England, we like windows. And we have this quaint belief that the purpose of a window is to let light into the inside of a building. Don't ask me how that belief got started. New Englanders used to believe in a lot of odd things, including slavery and killing Indians and witches. But some of the old beliefs made a certain sense, like hamburger should be fresh, and if you want a girly show, go to a burlesque hall, not a restaurant, and windows should have some connection to illuminating the inside of a building. Then there's the new branch of a bank they just built in downtown East Hartford. On the roof of this new little one-story frame building, they put a fake widow's walk. Now, in an old house overlooking the sea, in an old New England seacoast town, you might find a so-called widow's walk. It's a flat platform surrounded by a railing at the very top of the roof. The sea captain's wife could get there through a trap door and gaze out to sea, searching for her husband's ship. Maybe she's praying for his safe return. Maybe she wants to be sure he's well out to sea before she meets her lover. I don't know. That's up to her. But a widow's walk wasn't just decoration. It had a function for human beings. Sort of like a window. But here's a new one-story bank building in the heart of downtown East Hartford. And from the bank's widow's walk, a captain's wife could gaze out at the ugly three-story buildings surrounding it. You couldn't possibly catch a glimpse of the sea, or even the Connecticut River a half a mile away. At best, from the widow's walk, you'd have a nice view of the cars driving up and down Main Street. And maybe you'd see a dark red 2002 Road King glide by, heading for the Charter Oak Bridge, heading out of town, heading towards Uncasville, or Tariffville, or Hebron, or Heartland, maybe even exceeding the speed limit. feeling empty and aching and I don't know why. Trying to leave behind what Gene Shepherd called creeping meatballism and what Frank Zappa called plastic. Searching for a world where the hamburger is fresh and the windows let in light and the widow's walks have a view of the sea and the waitress doesn't ask, how am I doing today? And when I find this El Dorado, I'm going to put down my kickstand and turn off the ignition and recharge my batteries. This is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of
hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. As I frequently mention, there's so much evidence that the official account of what happened on 9/11 can't possibly be true. First and foremost, it defies the laws of physics concerning how the towers came down. There's ample evidence of controlled demolition, and there are over 2,412, to date, architects and engineers attesting to this fact and demanding a new investigation. And secondly, there's an obvious cover-up going on. The 9/11 commissioners themselves have admitted that they were obstructed in their investigation. Their chief legal counsel, John Farmer, said that we don't have the truth, and it's been documented that the 9/11 commission report itself was written based on an outline prepared in advance by Philip Zelikow before the 9/11 commission had even met. And there are thousands of facts just like these that completely destroy the official story. Also, we know that the global war on terror is a fabrication justified by 9/11 to get citizens' support through fear for the military attacks, invasions, and occupations of oil, mineral, and drug-rich countries like Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, Syria, Iran. All of these countries also were not connected to the central bankers. They refuse to be puppets for the West. So everyone in the 9/11 truth movement agrees that the government account of 9/11 is false. But when it comes to the details of what did or did not happen, there's lots of disagreement. We know that the 9/11 truth movement has been infiltrated, and that part of breaking up any organization or movement involves sowing discord within the organization. I observe these activities at work frequently in the 9/11 truth movement. And that brings me to the topic of today's show. Rebecca Roth, a retired flight attendant of 30 years, came out with a novel about 9/11 called Methodical Illusion in the fall of 2014. I interviewed her on the show, and you can hear that interview on radioforall.net, and that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. Once on the site, look under contributors, and then Cheryl with a C. And the show should pop up. But back to Rebecca. In her first novel, Methodical Illusion, she reveals new information that the planes on 9/11 were all sent to Westover Air Force Base in Massachusetts. She talks about the 10 hijackers being still alive and about the flight attendants who made phone calls the morning of 9/11. She believes they made the calls from the Westover Air Force Base and not from the airplanes, since the technology to make these calls from the aircraft didn't exist at that time. Rebecca came out with her second novel about 9/11 called Methodical Delusion,
and it just came out recently in the fall of 2015. This new book reveals the Israeli art students that rented space in one of the World Trade Center towers prior to 9/11. And she shows photos on her website, RebeccaRoth.com, of these art students in the towers with cases of fuse holders stacked on the wall behind them. She talks about the art student's name, Gelatin, and the Israeli art student's spy ring operation in the U.S. at that time. Carl Cameron on Fox News also reported on them after 9/11. Many were arrested and sent back to Israel. She's been attacked by several people in the 9/11 truth movement as being a fraud. Jim Fetzer is one of them. If you want to hear what he has to say, go to YouTube and search for Jim Fetzer and Rebecca Roth. And Rebecca is spelled with a K. Another person questioning her is Kurt Haskell. And Kurt is with a K. He's the lawyer who was on the flight with the underwear bomber and revealed the anomalies with the government's story about what happened there. Here are some of their criticisms about Rebecca Roth. First, they said that Rebecca Roth is not her real name. They said she's not married, as she says she is. She gives the wrong age. She was never a flight attendant. And that her email address comes from Langley, Virginia, which, of course, is where the CIA headquarters is located. They say that she is a chemist and sells essential oils online, and they provide a video of a woman, which seems to have a voice very similar to Rebecca's, speaking with a guy named Mike Harris, which is the name of her publisher. And then they come up with what they say her real name is. But Fetzer's name for her is different from the name that Kurt Haskell comes up with. From what I can see, there's not much criticism of what she says, but mostly personal criticisms of her and who she is. According to Fetzer, her role is to resurrect that there were passengers and planes on 9/11. But many in the truth movement would agree with her on that. Fetzer says that there were no passengers involved, but I personally know of a woman, I used to work with her, whose brother-in-law was on one of the planes and died, as far as the family's concerned, unless something else happened that we don't know about. Kurt Haskell said he knows her real name, and it's not the name Fetzer gives, but he won't say what it is, then slips as he's speaking and says her first name is Sarah. So Rebecca Roth has now come out, actually 2 days before the recording of this show, to set the record straight. So I wanted to share it with you. You can be the judge for yourself of what you think's really going on here. As she's talking, copies of her documents showing her real name, which is, and she admits that Rebecca Roth is a pseudonym. Her real name is Corey Ann Ashley Noorani. And she's also posted papers there that show that she was a flight attendant for Northwest Airlines. She has her own radio show that gets posted on YouTube. So you can see these documents if you go to YouTube and search for the Rebecca Roth Show Truth Out. Now, the name of this episode was Truth Out. In the clip you're about to hear, she's joined by someone named Alan who appears to work with her on the radio program. So here's the clip.
First, I'd like to just kind of clear the air. As I called this episode Truth Out, I would just like everyone to know that in the fall of 2014, I had finished writing a book that exposed what happened to the planes and passengers on 9/11. I discovered this using government data and also using my 30-year airline career, knowing the FAA hijacking protocols that were not followed by the flight attendants or the pilots, and continuing to look and using information that I knew about cell phones, etc. Well, I sat on that information in that book for nearly 2 years, and then I decided to release it all in this novel. I chose to use the pen name Rebecca Roth to help protect me from those who might do me harm, because I knew that the information that I had was rather explosive. Understandably so, you think about people like Michael Hastings, Andrew Breitbart, Art Bell, who just recently shut down his show for fear of his life and harassment by these trolls. So I knew that I had disclosed information in this book and that my sequel would come out that were potentially risky to my own life. As a matter of fact, when I do interviews, almost every person who's ever interviewed me in the last 14 months has asked me if I fear my life from the government. Never in my wildest dreams did I think that the threat would come from those who profess to want to know the truth about 9/11. We often refer to them as 9/11 truthers. For the past 13 months, and particularly the past several weeks, the internet truther trolls have been attempting to expose me as a fraud, and they have made claims that I never flew as a flight attendant and a purser in order to discredit my airline career. I have said in my books, everything that I've said in my books is true, and I can only imagine that they are actually working to help protect the real perpetrators of 9/11 that I have exposed. There is no other explanation. So how wrong they are, because things are going to come out again in another novel. They have been anxiously engaged in uncovering every aspect of my personal life. Some of it's true, most of it is not. They put the lives of innocent people and friends at risk, and I just cannot abide by that. They have crossed a line, so I have decided to come out underneath the pen name Rebecca Roth and tell you my real name and prove to you once and for all that I'm not a fraud. I'm not a CIA agent, as they claim. I'm not a chemist working for a six-year-old essential oil company. I am not a chemist at all. I was a purser, and I did fly for nearly 30 years, retiring in 2004. In the ensuing years, I have done many things. I have been retired for nearly 11 years, but of late, I have spent my life researching and exposing elements of 9/11 no one to this point had yet discovered. And what I will reveal in my upcoming books will blow the lid completely off what we thought we knew about 9/11. It's a very damning information. So you have to ask yourself, is this really what these internet trolls are trying to prevent coming to light? I don't have an answer. People ask me and I just don't know. But just so that you know, that I flew from 1973 to 2004, you can do the math. And yes, indeed, I was 21 to start my career. I was able to speak about this because I did not retire with a pension. It wasn't an option for me when I decided to leave just a few years after 9/11. I have never received a degree in chemistry, although I have mentioned in many interviews that part of the reason I was able to go through all the 9/11 information and the government documents I have is that I did study organic and biochemistry while I was in college, but I was in college during my airline career, because we have really great days off and our jobs allow us to do that. I didn't get a degree because I was in a car accident, and so I just didn't finish. But learning how to research the way I did in those forms of chemistry has allowed me to go through and dissect the information about 9/11 like no one else. So I just want you to understand that, because there's been a lot of people lying about things I've said. I have never worked for American Airlines, but as you'll see when you look at the pictures, that I was a flight attendant and an international purser for Northwest Airlines. So there you go, and you will be able to clearly see my real name. So I hope you've enjoyed this bit of information, and do you have anything you want to add to that there, Ramjet?
Well, you know, it's always been amazing to me that people have, you know, been concerned about the fact that Rebecca Roth wasn't your real name. I mean, it was pretty obvious. I think anybody knew that. Authors write under pen names and pseudonyms all the time. J.K. Rowling, for example, did that. I mean, her publisher asked her to drop her first name and use two initials so that it looked like it was being written by a man. She has since written several other books using a total man's
name. Doesn't she use a man's name?
Man's name, yeah, she does. And that's not uncommon, because you're looking for an opportunity to sell books or to present information to people that will take that, and a pen name often does that. But in other words, it also protects people from the invading eyes of people who want to know all your business. And that happens all the time. And so you did that innocently, hoping that it would protect you and the people you care about. But for whatever reason, these internet trolls have decided that they just wanted to find every aspect about you. And it's not like you've got anything that you're trying to hide.
The thing that really bothered me the most is that they have posted on the internet a woman's name and home address in Texas that I don't even know who she is. She doesn't know me. They claimed I went to college out of the country and in Texas. No, in fact, I did not. And I am not her, and she's not me, and she doesn't even know this. But I'm sure, like I've been harassed for the last 13 months by some of these trolls on the internet, and I'm going to list their names. We're going to do another show. We're going to expose all of the trolls, and we're going to put you out there. And most of these trolls have gotten a free book, or some of them too. I can think of two people or several people that got both books for free because they were doing radio shows. And one of the things that happened when I started doing the Rebecca Roth Show or the Reality Check is that I brought in a very large live audience, a live listeners, and the people that were making money from the websites in memberships or charging you to listen to the archives were very, very angry that I left because they were making money off me. And I wasn't making any money off anyone. So they're angry, and that's part of this. I don't understand why it is so important when these are two novels filled with 9/11 research using United States government documentation.
Well, the other thing, too, is these are all men. And they're all angry, and they're all jealous, and they all have egos that they're trying to protect. And for a woman to come forward and present information that had never before been presented in the way that you're able to do that, that makes perfect logical sense, was very threatening to them. And so this is how they've decided to deal with that particular threat, is to make your life a living hell.
Yeah, and they're doing that. And so they've endangered innocent people, my friends, my family.
And people you don't even know.
And people I don't even know, and people I don't even know I don't know, because it's really ridiculous. At this point, I'm now accused of being more than a dozen different people. But most importantly, I think that the main trolls, the two main trolls, but they have a troop of them, would like you to believe that I was never a flight attendant. So one of the things I'm going to ask you to do is on my YouTube channel, there is a YouTube that I did, and I've got another one that's ready to upload shortly with a flight attendant who is going by the pen name, pseudonym of Anna. She flew for American Airlines. I did not. I flew for Northwest Airlines. You can clearly see that in all my documentation that is floating in front of your face as we speak. So Anna has joined me again. And again, we're going to talk about some of the 9/11 stuff and some of the just our airline stuff. And she's going to join me again. I've got probably a dozen more flight attendants that I'm going to do some shows with because we do bring a perspective that no one else does. Now, I guess this is really intimidating to these trolls that airline professionals are now out there speaking. And yes, indeed, we are. And I would like to thank you all. And I'm going to ask one favor of every single person that listens to this, that you make this video go viral. And that if you have friends or family that cannot and have not yet woken up to the truth about 9/11, I wrote these books to wake up the person on the street, not an internet troll or a 9/11 truther that thinks they know everything or they think no planes operated, as some of these trolls do. It's like the flat earth people. I mean, I see there's a video out, Rebecca Roth thinks the earth is not flat. And so they're trolling on that aspect. But this particular gentleman, oh, I can't even call him that. This particular troll would like you to believe that no airplanes took off that day. Yes, indeed, they did. And I'm talking with their friends and their families and their coworkers. And I have been talking to them for 13 months now. So I guess if we don't go along with his no plane theory, then he's going to attack anyone that he thinks looks like, smells like, acts like, talks like Rebecca Roth. So here you go. And what I'd like you to do is every single time you keep a copy of this link and every single time you see somebody claiming that Rebecca Roth is a fraud and that I never flew and that I was a chemist. Oh, the best part is I'm a CIA agent. As if the CIA can't find anyone in their 30s, they have to find a grandmother in her 60s. This is just insane. And that's actually one of the things, besides being accused of being a half a dozen people, that most people wake up for. To this one particular troll, it's like, why would she exposed the CIA involvement in her books if she was a CIA agent? That doesn't make any sense. No, it doesn't. And if I were, I'd be dead. I mean, you can just look around, people that were associated with the CIA, that pilot Philip Marshall, other people that had experience working with or for the CIA once they think that they're going to talk. And I've already talked. I've got two books published, and I'm hoping the third will come out in March or April. And it's going to be a mind blower. So we just want to leave you with that. And as soon as I can get better internet upload speed, I'm going to upload two segments or 1 hour and a half show that I did with Anna.
And just in the future, we're working on being able to present the Rebecca Roth Show on a weekly, maybe daily, maybe hourly, who knows, basis. And you'll be able to hear us, and we'll be talking about the common, everyday, run-of-the-mill events, plus the things that Rebecca has been researching. I think we're going to try to expose some of the things that are going to be in her book so you can be prepared for that. You know, there's so much information in this third book that it's just mind-blowing. But we look forward to it. We want you to know that we appreciate you as an audience.
Yeah, and that's right. I just want to also let you know that since my second book came out, I've been joined by people that I like to call a real American patriots. These are people that have served in our military, served in special forces, a special operations unit, DARPA, research and development scientists, and air traffic controllers, not to mention pilots, flight attendants, and pursers. Together, we have formed a team that has uncovered absolutely mind-blowing stuff. So yes, indeed, by coming out with my real name, my life is in danger. And thank you to the trolls for doing that. And most of the people, by the way, either got a free book or never read the book. So those of you that did read the book, you know what's what. And those of you who have listened to the interviews that I've done, how anybody could listen to that and question my 30-plus year career is just beyond me. So that's all I have to say. Well, thank you for joining us. And please help me make this information go viral. And I know the trolls want to hurt, but they have not hurt book sales. So if you want to get autographed books or you want to get books to put into your local library, please contact us. And I'm going to put a link to the store in the links down below. So you can go right to there to get an autographed book or to buy books in bulk or get a book, whatever. There's lots of things going on. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
So there you've just heard author Rebecca Roth's comments and thoughts on the criticism she's been receiving. The only thing she admits to is that Rebecca Roth is a pseudonym, her pen name. And this is not unusual. Just think of Mark Twain, for example. And I can understand why she might want to protect herself by not using her real name. I don't see that she's putting out any information that would actually help the real perpetrators of 9/11. In fact, I think it's just the opposite. However, she could actually appear too good to be true. Yet most of what she says is backed up by other researchers, with a few exceptions, like the planes going to Westover Air Force Base. But even that sounds plausible and makes a lot of sense in conjunction with other aspects of 9/11. One of the criticisms of her is that she blames Israel for 9/11, thus taking the focus off of people in our own government. But this is not the case because she also discusses Rumsfeld, Cheney, Leon Panetta on 9/11 and their corporate connections. And she talks about the fact that the four flights were not intercepted on 9/11 by the U.S. Air Force. So I'm sure the battle's not over, since the cognitive infiltrators will use any discord to their advantage. I hope this show has shed some light on the situation. Hopefully more research by others on these issues that Rebecca has brought up will enlighten us. And as a final note on this topic, Rebecca Roth's second book, Methodical Deception, is much better written than her first book, Methodical Illusion. And again, her website is RebeccaRoth.com. Sometimes there are people who do phenomenal work investigating what's really out there. Perhaps Rebecca Roth is one of these types of people. Time will tell. One person who I've always admired for his phenomenal research and reporting is James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com. So I'm going to end the show today with his roughly 5-minute message on 9/11 that came out a few years ago, but needs to be heard occasionally. It's actually better to watch his video of this, and I would encourage you to do so. The humor comes through more strongly with the video, but since I do radio, here's the audio version.
On the morning of September 11th, 2001, 19 men armed with box cutters directed by a man on dialysis in a cave fortress halfway around the world using a satellite phone and a laptop directed the most sophisticated penetration of the most heavily defended airspace in the world, overpowering the passengers and the military combat trained pilots on four commercial aircraft before flying those planes wildly off course for over an hour without being molested by a single fighter interceptor. These 19 hijackers, devout religious fundamentalists who like to drink alcohol, snort cocaine, and live with pink-haired strippers, managed to knock down three buildings with two planes in New York, While in Washington, a pilot who couldn't handle a single-engine Cessna was able to fly a 757 in an 8,000-foot descending 270-degree corkscrew turn to come exactly level with the ground, hitting the Pentagon in the budget analyst office where DOD staffers were working on the mystery of the $2.3 trillion that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld had announced missing from the Pentagon's coffers in a press conference the day before, on September 10, 2001. Luckily, the news anchors knew who did it within minutes.
Osama bin Laden.
The pundits knew within hours.
Osama bin Laden.
The administration knew within the day.
Terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them.
And the evidence literally fell into the FBI's lap.
That a hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
But for some reason, a bunch of crazy conspiracy theorists demanded an investigation into the greatest attack on American soil in history. That investigation was delayed, underfunded, set up to fail, a conflict of interest, and a cover-up from start to finish. It was based on testimony extracted through torture, the records of which were destroyed. It failed to mention the existence of WTC-7, Able Danger, PTEC, Sibel Edmonds, OBL and the CIA, and the drills of hijacked aircraft being flown into buildings that were being simulated at the precise same time that those events were actually happening. It was lied to by the Pentagon, the CIA, the Bush administration, and as for Bush and Cheney, well, no one knows what they told it because they testified in secret, off the record, not under oath, and behind closed doors. It didn't bother to look at who funded the attacks because that question is ultimately of little practical significance. Still, the 9/11 Commission did brilliantly answering all of the questions the public had, except most of the victims' family members' questions, and pinned blame on all the people responsible, although no one so much as lost their job, determining the attacks were
failure of imagination.
Because
nobody in our government, at least, and I don't think the prior government that could envision flying airplanes into buildings.
Except the Pentagon, FEMA, NORAD, and the NRO. The DIA destroyed 2.5 terabytes of data on Able Danger, but that's okay because it probably wasn't important. The SEC destroyed their records on the investigation into the insider trading before the attacks, but that's okay because destroying the records of the largest investigation in SEC history is just part of routine record keeping. NIST has classified the data that they used for their model of WTC-7's collapse, but that's okay because knowing how they made their model of the collapse would jeopardize public safety. The FBI has argued that all material related to their investigation of 9/11 should be kept secret from the public, but that's okay because the FBI probably has nothing to hide. This man never existed, nor is anything he had to say worthy of your attention, and if you say otherwise, you are a paranoid conspiracy theorist and deserve to be shunned by all of humanity. Likewise, him, 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 and her. And her, and her, and him. Osama bin Laden lived in a cave fortress in the hills of Afghanistan, but somehow got away. Then he was hiding out in Tora Bora, but somehow got away. Then he lived in Abbottabad for years, taunting the most comprehensive intelligence dragnet employing the most sophisticated technology in the history of the world for a decade, releasing video after video with complete impunity and getting younger and younger as he did so, before finally being found in a daring SEAL team raid which wasn't recorded on video, in which he didn't resist or use his wife as a human shield, and in which these crack special forces operatives panicked and killed this unarmed man, supposedly the best source of intelligence about those dastardly terrorists on the entire planet. Then they dumped his body in the ocean before telling anyone about it. Then a couple dozen of that team's members died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. This is the story of 9/11, brought to you by the media which told you the hard truths about
his head could be seen to move violently forward.
And
they took the babies out of incubators.
And
mobile production facilities.
And
the rescue of Jessica Lynch.
If you have any questions about this story, you are a batshit paranoid tinfoil dog-abusing baby hater and will be reviled by everyone. If you love your country and or freedom, happiness, rainbows, rock and roll, puppy dogs, apple pie, and your grandma, you will never ever express doubts about any part of this story to anyone. Ever. This has been a public service announcement by the friends of the FBI, CIA, NSA, DIA, SEC, MSM, White House, NIST, and the 9/11 Commission. Because ignorance is strength.
And again, the video of this is worth seeing and sharing. You can find it on YouTube by looking under James Corbett and 9/11, or on the website CorbettReport.com. And Corbett is spelled C-O-R-B-E-T-T. So CorbettReport.com. And now I'm going to end the show by reading a few sentences from a recently posted article on the website GlobalResearch.ca by the website's founder, Professor Michelle Chosadovsky. The article is called Al-Qaeda and the Human Mindset, the Threat of the Islamic State, an Incessant and Repetitive Public Discourse. And here goes. Al-Qaeda-ISIS concepts, repeated ad nauseum, have potentially traumatic impacts on the human mind and the ability of normal human beings to analyze and comprehend the real outside world of war, politics, and the economic crisis. Al-Qaeda constitutes a stylized, fake, and almost folkloric abstraction of terrorism, which permeates the inner consciousness of millions of people around the world. With Al-Qaeda, however, there are no verifiable facts and concepts because Al-Qaeda has evolved into a media mythology, a legend, an invented ideological construct used as an unsubtle tool of media disinformation and war propaganda. The routine use of Al-Qaeda to generate blanket explanations of complex political events is meant to create confusion. It prevents people from thinking. And I'll leave you with that thought. And I hope you'll check out the great website that this article came from. It's globalresearch.ca, and it's one of my favorite websites for making sense of what's really going on in this post-9/11 world that we live in. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Well, to staunch the flow of immigrants to the U.S., President Obama, who some now refer to as deporter-in-chief's Department of Homeland Security, has been preparing a national operation to deport Central American families who have evaded removal orders, according to government officials. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a DHS unit, plans to start rounding up hundreds of families that entered the U.S. without documents and deport them. Joining us now is Oscar Chacon, Executive Director of Alianza Americas, an immigrant himself from El Salvador. Chacon is a frequent lecturer on Latino immigrant issues in the United States and the impacts of Latino diaspora in Latin America. And thank you for joining us again at a moment that I find terribly disturbing, and I'm just absolutely chagrined and do not understand the politics of the Obama administration in this proposal to ramp up the deportations focusing on Central American immigrants. And thank you for joining us, Oscar Chacon. Help us understand what the heck are the politics behind this tremendously disturbing development.
Mimi, it's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be happy to try to explain the logic behind these news that were first published on the 23rd of December by the Washington Post, and it has subsequently been printed also by other major newspapers, including the New York Times. First of all, I mean, I think it is important to put this in a bit of historical context. The notion that if we as a nation treat in a harsh, very strongly driven by a logic of punishment, people who dare to come to this country without the proper visa, that will somehow stop, you know, the flow of people from doing so. It's actually a notion that goes back quite a few years, to be honest. I mean, it goes back many, many years. But in the most recent stretch of time, this notion was embedded into law back in 1986. It was actually part of a major immigration reform law that was passed in that year. And one of the components of that law was precisely to beef up military control of our U.S. southern border as a way of essentially deterring people, particularly from Mexico, to actually dare to enter the United States of America without inspection. That logic, unfortunately, has continued very much vibrant, you know, within policymaking in relationship to immigration. The 1996 immigration law took that notion to a much higher level, where, again, I mean, the idea that if we are harsh, if we punish with severity people who come into this country without visas, they will stop coming. This is exactly what has led to the situation we are dealing with now. As you may recall, and people who are listening may recall, going back about 2 years, a very significant increase in the number of Central American children, many of them unaccompanied, as well as families, began to enter the United States through the U.S. southern border. That surge was characterized by our own President Obama as a crisis at the southern border. As a result, a lot of people were being apprehended and kept in detention facilities at border town areas, particularly in Texas. And the ultimate outcome of that was that almost everyone who tried to enter, even though they were, you know, clearly coming here because they were stating so, as a result of conditions of persecution, violence, a total chaos in their local communities, and an overall lack of perception that there was any opportunity to stay home, they were actually issued deportation orders. They were given basically the initial proceedings towards their deportation, but in many instances they were let free because there was a lot of pressure on the administration that it was simply inhumane to pretend that these people should be kept in detention forever. And as a result, and I'm talking about essentially tens of thousands of cases, not hundreds or just a few thousand, but several tens of thousands of cases, which basically fall in what I just generally described. Many of these people, since they were released to family in the U.S., have actually been given court dates. Unfortunately, the majority of them have not been able to secure experienced legal representation. As a result, court orders were reaffirmed, especially because when these people were supposed to show up for a hearing, nobody showed up, and so they were basically deported in absentia. This is the population that the news that we learn about on the 23rd of December are basically speaking about. And just so that we understand, there are about 13,000 active cases right now, namely cases that were already given a court date, nobody showed up, and the immigration judge issued a deportation order in absentia. That is potentially the population right now that may be the target of this supposed plan to go in the form of raids into their homes to actually retrieve them, put them in detention, and eventually deport them. Now, it's also important to keep in mind that number keeps growing on a daily basis because there are hearings happening on a daily basis. And as I already said, a lot of this population simply have not been able to secure adequate representation, because it is important for the people who are listening to know that while we acknowledge the right of people to pursue humanitarian protection via existing law, we do not provide legal representation to those people who are indeed fleeing for their lives. And the last point I would make is that even our existing humanitarian protection laws, particularly political asylum, is still a set of laws that were written long ago and do not quite reflect, you know, the conditions that are making people like Hondurans, Guatemalans, Salvadorians flee their countries nowadays. So there is even a need for us to review how in the international community to review the very theory behind humanitarian protection, because, again, humanitarian protection laws nowadays do not quite make room for people, for example, running away from gangs-driven violence in many of these countries, which, as most people should know, happens to be a very severe problem in every one of these countries. So that is the best way I can generally describe how is it that we get them into this news of this plan, you know, for a mass deportation. Now, one other piece of information I would add is we believe that at this point in time, it is important to make President Obama aware about how bad it would be if this plan indeed were to become official policy and this plan were to indeed be implemented, simply because it would create havoc, you know, within thousands of homes, thousands of households. There is a good chance that the people that they may be targeting no longer resides in the address that they had in file, but somebody else does. And so there will be a lot of collateral cost involved also in this kind of operation. And we feel, again, very strongly that right now what the president should do, if he really wants to shake off the notion that he is indeed deporter-in-chief, is to backtrack on this plan and acknowledge that this particular population deserves protection and not detention and deportation.
Well, Oscar Chacon, what has actually become of the announcement of the series of executive actions that included the deferred action for parents of Americans and lawful permanent residents, or what became known as DAPA, and things such as the deferred action for childhood arrivals, DACA? How does that juxtapose, or what's become of that in relationship to this really onslaught by the ICE through the really administration of President Obama?
Well, you may recall, and our listeners, you know, may welcome just a refresher, on the 20th of November, 2014, President Obama announced finally that he would grant immigration relief to two different segments of population of immigrants residing in the U.S. without authorization. One was essentially an additional layer of young immigrants originally excluded from the so-called deferred action for childhood arrivals. So that's why this program was actually known as DACA Plus, as well as a new segment of people who happen to be parents of U.S. citizens or U.S. permanent residents, but who they themselves didn't have, you know, immigration status. Unfortunately, by the time the president took these actions, after years of many organizations like the one I happen to lead advocating for the usage of that kind of authority, which we knew the president had, but that unfortunately president kept saying that he did not have the authority, it turned out to be too late, because even though we were in celebratory mode immediately after the announcement was made, the reality is that forces that oppose any kind of fair treatment of people who reside in the U.S. without authorization were able to neutralize, using the court system, specifically a lawsuit that originated in Texas and that was joined by, in the end, 26 other states. They were able to put an injunction essentially prohibiting the implementation of this program. And as of today, unfortunately, the case remains under injunction. There cannot be any implementation of it up until now. And the best hope that we have now is that the Supreme Court will schedule this case to be heard in their next term and that they will affirm the right of the executive to grant this kind of relief. Now, that is the best-case scenario, what I am describing. There is a chance that the court may decide not to hear the case, in which instance, I mean, what is going to happen is that President Obama will go out of office by the beginning of next year without actually seeing any implementation of this particular law. That could also be an outcome. And so to make a long story short, nobody has received immigration relief as a result of the announcement made by the president on the 20th of November of 2014.
Well, to get back to this recent announcement, the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jeff Johnson in recent months has warned that really their purpose is twofold. One, it aims to send the message to would-be crossers. Love the way they refer to people. This is their terminology. Would-be crossers that they won't be allowed to remain in the U.S. And then they also seek to address the safety concerns involved as adults entrust their lives and those of their children to human smugglers. So that's the face that they're putting on this really expanded and targeted deportation process that they are about to go through. How do you respond to Secretary Johnson's thoughts on the matter?
Well, I mean, frankly, it's a very naive interpretation of why are these people coming to the U.S. I think it is unfortunate that somebody so smart, I mean, as Secretary Johnson, who I definitely believe understands that the reason behind this latest flow of Central American nationals going all the way to the U.S. has essentially to do with the deep level of insecurity, the deep level of violence that these communities are facing, and the fact that the only country on earth where they have a relative, where they have a parent, where they have a brother, a sister, happens to be the United States of America. And that, therefore, we should be focusing on two things. On one hand, working patiently to overcome the reality of instability that is real now and that has been real for a while. And that's going to take, frankly, years, you know, for it to happen. And on the other hand, we should be protecting people who are running away from these conditions of insecurity, which, frankly, let me remind everybody, we have a degree of responsibility as a country because we ourselves have been in the business of sending back people who grow up in the U.S., who are foreign nationals, who became eventually involved in gangs, and we just send them back, you know, to Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, knowing perfectly well that these countries' governments did not have any capacity whatsoever to really manage in a smart way, you know, this particular behavior on our part. So, again, I think that the position that has been taken by the Obama administration, by Secretary Johnson, since the search, so-called search, of Central American children and adults coming to the U.S. began to take place, has been mistaken. I mean, they've been basically saying we have to put them in detention, we have to keep them detained for as long as need be, and when time comes, we need to be harsh in deporting them because that is the only message we can send that will result in fewer people coming. As if that is going to take care of the very triggering factors that are making tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, I would say, of people from these three countries in particular to make the harsh decision of having to leave their countries to come to a place like the United States of America.
And as we look towards the new year and what our agenda must be, and perhaps what is not being said by any of the candidates for office on the Democratic side, much less the Republican side, who are almost universally reactionary, what needs to be the message? What needs to be the immediate message in response to this ensuing action on the part of the Department of Homeland Security to step up deportation of Central American children and their families who are fleeing violence? What do we need to say and do about that? And the ongoing agenda for meaningful immigration reform?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think that what needs to be done is to persuade President Obama that this is simply the wrong approach to the particular case of Central Americans trying to come in. What we need to do is to remind everyone that we are not talking about millions and millions of people. We are talking, in the worst of cases, hundreds of thousands of people who, frankly, do not represent a sizable number vis-a-vis, you know, our overall population. I mean, how is it conceivable that, you know, the arrival of a few hundred thousand Central American people seeking safe haven, seeking protection in the U.S., is going to put us in crisis? And second of all, I think it is important also to educate the population, educate even elected officials, people running for office, even our president, presidential candidates, that there is a big problem happening in Central America, which most people do not understand. You know, we tend to often say that protection should be granted, for example, to people running away from conditions of violence, persecution, war in the Middle East. Well, frankly, both cases are equally deserving, and we should be making everything possible to be indeed the beacon of hope that we have always been. Sadly, the flow of human beings, including those running away because of conditions of persecution, because of conditions of violence, have been conjugated, you know, with the notion that this may be people representing a national security threat. We need to once and for all separate, you know, the fact that there are people seeking safe haven from the fact that, yes, there may well be, you know, threats against our national security, but they're not at all the same thing. And for as long as we keep mixing them, we are going to simply keep ignoring our humanitarian duties, protecting people like those who are fleeing on a daily basis from Central American countries.
So the immediate message to Obama to protect, not to deport, who should we specifically direct our attention to?
Well, I think that the president ought to be target number one, I mean, in this particular effort to get us on the right track about protecting, not deporting people who are indeed running away for their lives and seeking safe haven in the United States of America. Second of all, I think that everybody who has come to learn about this issue over the last couple of years, be that, you know, a church leader, be that a local elected official, be that a U.S. representative, a U.S. senator, should also be voicing their concern about the notion that we are simply going to round up people and send them back to the very conditions that they left in the first place. I think that those are two key targets. Now, if the president were to come out and be supportive of this announcement, then I think that we would be talking of a different context, and the responses that would need to be given are going to be significantly different. But in the end, I mean, directed to essentially inject some common sense in our national policy so that we correct this potential threat of seeing tens of thousands of people becoming the targets of deportation. I think President Obama should think about his legacy. I mean, does he really want to be remembered as the deporter-in-chief, or does he want to be remembered as somebody who was able to inject logic and common sense to our debate and do what is right, even though it may not be the most popular thing? But again, I mean, many presidents before him have done tons of things that weren't popular, but that were absolutely the correct approach to take in a situation like this.
So call the White House switchboard at 202-456-1414. That is 202-456-1414 and say protect Central American children and families who seek safe haven. Do not raid and deport Central American children and families. And as always, Oscar Chacon, for the work that you do for enlightening us, we very much appreciate your being with us and want very much for a sane, rational, humane immigration policy, which we obviously have to take the responsibility for pushing on. And we have been speaking with Oscar Chacon, Executive Director of Alianza Americas. You've been terrific.
My best wishes to you and to all of your listeners.
And for all of you listening in the new year ahead, if we want peace, we have to work for justice. And let's make it so even more than we have in 2015. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. It has been a pleasure, as always, speaking with you.
Amanecer, lo ves, a la luz de la aurora, lo que tanto aclamamos, la noche al caer, sus estrellas, sus trazos,
sus estrellas.
Nuestro himno from Somos Americanos. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Manners is really at heart about our relationships, our interactions. And so this book is kind of the one-stop reference guide for, you know, everyone in our community. We're getting married, folks who are coming out more and more in the workplace, and families too, to moms, to dads, and, you know, you're dealing with teachers and kids. It's also for our straight friends, coworkers, and family members. They get invited to our weddings. They work with us. Folks come out to them. They meet transgender people, and they are completely befuddled.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. In the headlines this week, Greek lawmakers okay civil partnerships, a gay man sues for civil marriage equality in China, Malawi drops gay sex charges against two men, and Tunisia jails six offenders for 3 years. We'll have details on those stories and other news in or affecting sexual minorities around the world when NewsWrap returns next week. Our traditional year-ending Pride on Screen special has been postponed, but fear not, Steve Pride's take on this year's queer movies and TV will air on the first two This Way Outs of the new year. And coming up, Steve chats with the author of Stephen Petro's complete book of gay and lesbian manners. But first, This Way Out queer lit commentator Janet Mason opens three queer-positive books about LGBT people and religion: Gay Conversations with God by James Alexander Langteau, The Peace Seeker by Susan E. Gilmore, and Coming Out in Faith, Voices of LGBTQ Unitarian Universalists, edited by Susan A. Gore and Keith Cron.
When I read Gay Conversations with God, Straight Talk on Fanatics, Fags, and the God Who Loves Us All by James Alexander Langteau from Finhorn Press, I had a little snicker. The author was a senior producer and the host of the Christian 700 Club. He writes that invariably after an ex-gay show, where men who had been through a so-called reparative conversion, which is condemned by the American Psychiatric Association, the, quote, cured men would hit on him. His response was that it sounded fun, but what would their lesbian wives and their 17 children think? My snicker at this hypocrisy stayed with me as a kind of joy that arose every time I heard anything about the 700 Club. I came to think that maybe God, feel free to substitute any other words that work for you, divine, great spirit, and definitely she as well as he, wants me to feel that joy. The book is written glibly, but leaves no doubt that the author has been through it as a result of being gay and Christian. In The Peace Seeker, from Peace Seeker Press, author Susan E. Gilmore goes deeper in relating her struggles between her sexuality and her strong faith in the Baptist religion in which she was raised. She writes about her observation from a young age of the church's position that the role of women was to be submissive to men. The author is bright, intelligent, and driven, qualities that any organization, including her church, should develop and put to use. Instead, she was thrown out of Bible College for having a, quote, inappropriate sexual and romantic relationship with another female student. Ultimately, she is accepted by another Bible college and goes abroad to do missionary work. Since her entire life is based in her religion, the author partners with other Christian women. This is during the late 70s and early 80s, and there was a lesbian community in existence. At one point, when she comes home and becomes involved with another partner, the two of them attend a church together but stay in the closet. What follows is a harrowing tale of the couple being broken up by their church members and elders. Susan left that church, but at no point does she consider changing her religion or leaving it entirely. Coming out in Faith, Voices of LGBTQ Unitarian Universalists, edited by Susan A. Gore and Keith Cron, was a breath of fresh air. The writers in this collection share their experiences of being amazed at being around straight allies who are generally not homophobic. Social justice is a strong component of Unitarian Universalism, and LGBT rights are important. One of the writers is Drew Johnston, who identifies as a queer, bi, trans, Unitarian Universalist. Drew relates the experience of transitioning while being a UU minister. Drew attended a potluck dinner and took questions from the congregation. One person asked about gendered pronouns. Did I prefer male or female? Then I heard myself finally answer the question. I like it when people at least alternate, I said. Then I feel seen. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
So my brother says God is a flat-butted, crude-cutted linebacker, a macho babe hijacker, panting at the line of scrimmage. He makes God in his own image, and I don't begrudge him that. But his is a God who hates all fads, Jews, Hindus, and kids in rags. The Bible can thump like a big bass drum till every single sacred cow comes home. I know where that's at. God is why. God is why. God is why. You can't get around to the other side. You can't hold a runner and you sure can't hide. God is why. God is why. God is why. You can't run them and you sure can't hide. So my brother said.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis.
This is Janice Ian.
You're listening to This Way Out.
Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
If you want to do the right thing, but you're not sure what that is, the guy you want to talk to is Steve Pride's next guest.
Oscar Wilde once said, "The world is my oyster, but I used the wrong fork." Well, that would never happen to at least one person in my circle, because he wrote the definitive guide to LGBT life.
I'm Stephen Petro, the author of Stephen Petro's Complete Gay and Lesbian Manners, the Definitive Guide to LGBT Life.
Are gay manners different than straight manners?
It's really a situational thing. For gay folks, you know, we're in all these new relationships, you know, getting married, folks who are coming out more and more in the workplace, and same-sex families too, two moms, two dads, and, you know, you're dealing with teachers and kids. And manners is really at heart about our relationships, our interactions. And so this book is kind of the one-stop reference guide for, you know, everyone in our community to get some help on those new situations. And then on the other hand, it's also for our straight friends, coworkers, and family members. They get invited to our weddings. They work with us. Folks come out to them. They meet transgender people. And they are completely befuddled and don't know what to do. Most of them actually want to do the right thing, but they don't always know what it is. And if you go to some of the traditional manners books, we're pretty much absent. And usually the information that's there is not so helpful. In fact, some of it's even, you know, homophobic. So that's pretty much why I wrote the book. And that's pretty much how gay manners can be considered different than straight manners.
How did you become an expert in gay and lesbian manners? Was it like a high school career day that took a really wrong turn?
I joke that I am an accidental manners expert. Of course, I didn't grow up wanting to be Emily Post, but it's actually interesting. Emily Post, Amy Vanderbilt, Judith Martin, they were all journalists before they became manners advice experts. And I've been a journalist my working life. And maybe it's something about, you know, the inquiring mind or having, you know, certain repertorial skills that sort of pushed me into this. But I started doing an advice column on manners probably about 15 years ago, and it seemed to resonate. And there was a small book that came out of it, and now there's this really big book of gay manners that goes soup to nuts, or I like to say from womb to tomb. It starts with families and raising kids in a same-sex household and goes through dating and sex and so on and ends with illness and death and dying issues.
Your book on gay and lesbian manners is 448 pages. Not to be rude, but boil it down for me. What's the core message of the book?
I am a believer in respecting one another and respecting ourselves. And if there's a common theme in all the situations in the book, it is about respect. Someone said to me, well, how can you expect anyone to know all of those rules? And I said, well, it's really not that complicated. First of all, if you just go to the question, am I being respectful of myself? Am I being respectful of these other people? You usually can use your common sense to figure it out. I mean, we don't always have enough common sense. So, you know, that's a secondary message here. And, you know, even around challenging situations where someone uses an anti-gay slur, a first visceral response might be to get angry and to have a smackdown. But I actually don't think that's productive. So I encourage people there not to be silent, though, because silence is understood as agreement. But to say something like, it's a joke, a quote joke, that's not so funny. That offends me. And not to humiliate, but to draw a line and say, you know, that's not acceptable because these kind of words come from bullies and bullies will just raise the stakes. And we also know that words can lead to violence. So we have to speak up. But getting angry, it's not the first mode, not the second mode, but it happens too. Everyone gets provoked.
What about do's and don'ts for straight friends?
I have this really good friend, and I guess she had heard some gay folks using the word faggot. And, you know, they were using it, they thought, sort of within their own circle of gay friends. She overheard it, and so she used it later on with some other gay folks, not understanding that it sounds very different when it comes out of a straight person's mouth, and was immediately met with a very stony response from those. And she realized she had stepped into something inadvertently. And, you know, there was also sort of a question of language there. I think we have to be careful, too, about the language that we use. And that part of what happened there was that this group of gay guys was just going on and on about faggot this, faggot that, and not understanding that when you use language like that, it makes it seem acceptable. And if we want to use that sort of internally, we need to make sure that we're doing it internally.
One of the issues we have on this show is not knowing who's out. And even within that question, there are different levels of outness.
I often acknowledge that I am far from perfect when it comes to my manners, though I'm trying to be well-behaved today. But one of the worst gaffes I made was right around this particular question. I had a really good friend. She was out in her personal life. She had a partner. She had two kids. They had two kids. And I hadn't realized she wasn't out in the workplace. And she kind of kept her private life to herself. And so I outed her inadvertently in the workplace. And she was really unhappy about that, rightfully so, and called me out on it. And it really sort of buttressed the point that you're making, which is that we all make different decisions about our level of outness and in what arena we want to be out. And that is our right as an individual. And, you know, we always talk about when someone is coming out that It's on their own timetable. It's when they're ready. It's when they're in a trusting place with whomever they want to tell. So we don't want to mess it up for folks and out them in places where they don't want to be. But it's complicated. And then, you know, with Facebook, people are out there, but they're not out here. And it's crazy. And it's hard to do the right thing sometimes, even if you're trying to do it. And what happens is people who are in the closet, and I'm thinking of this one fellow I know, he has a boyfriend and he lives with his boyfriend, and they got tagged at a party and they got tagged as a couple. And then that wound up on his page. All of his relatives were there. That's how he got pushed out. And he was really angry. But, you know, I think there's some responsibility on both sides there. It's really hard to be out in one area and not, especially when you bring Facebook into it. But I would say one Facebook manners is, one important thing is, before you tag someone, ask for their permission, because any kind of picture can be tagged and then it goes anywhere, and that's really your choice.
Steve Pride continues his thoughtful and entertaining conversation with LGBT manners expert Steve Petro after this important message.
Hi, I'm NewsWrap reporter Christopher Gall. It's that time of the year again when many of our U.S. listeners consider ways to maximize their annual charitable tax deductions.
And I'm NewsWrap reporter Chris Ann Eastwood. No matter where you are in the world, log on to thiswayout.org to do your part to keep this nonprofit volunteer-based program going.
You'll also find some unique musical, cultural, and historical programming from the This Way Out archives as our way of saying thank you.
Please go to thiswayout.org to support our efforts to inform, entertain, and educate listeners around the world, or postal mail P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA.
From the This Way Out family to you and yours, happy holidays, and thank you.
And now back to Steve Pride as he asks LGBT manners guru Stephen Petro about the most common etiquette questions.
Someone once said that the test of good manners is to be patient with the bad ones. Good advice. But first, we've got to understand the difference.
I'm Stephen Petro, the author of Stephen Petro's Complete Gay and Lesbian Manners, the Definitive Guide to LGBT Life.
Stephen, what are the top five questions that you get most often?
Number one, what do I call the partner, boyfriend, lover, honey, husband of my gay friend? And this is straight folks and gay folks. And if you're a committed couple and you're straight, you're usually married and it's easy. If you're a committed couple and you're gay, though, there is no foundation to start with. So then you have couples choosing the terminology that they want, which is perfectly fine, but it's just perfectly confusing for everyone. So it's really important to listen to how a couple refers to each other. And when my partner and I moved from San Francisco to Chapel Hill, those nice folks that I was talking about earlier, they knew we were together, but they didn't know how to refer to us. And so they would say to me, how is, and then there would be this kind of stammer, stumbled, what is the word? How is your roommate, it started with? And then how is your friend? But they heard me use partner and they picked up on it. And then we have some lesbian friends who live down the street who had gotten married in Massachusetts, and they refer to each other as wife and wife, and everyone in our community, you know, refers to them that way. So there is no one size fits all, but it's really important to listen. And this is also a really good example of, if you're confused, it's fine to ask, how would you like me to introduce the two of you? And then we can say it. So this is evolving. We'll probably have more standardization as time goes on. But for now, again, be respectful, listen, ask, and you'll be all right. Number two has to deal with, is it okay to ask someone if they're gay? And again, this is asked by well-meaning straight people who want to help, who want to help someone come out. I remember I was in Phoenix and this woman asked the question and she said, he's my best friend. I've known him for 15 years and he just won't admit that he's gay. And I said, well, 15 years and he's your best friend. There's got to be some reason that he's not saying something. Either you're wrong, he's not gay, or he's not comfortable with you. And maybe you didn't notice, but you said admit that he's gay. And admit is kind of a harsh word. You admit that you did a crime. You don't admit to a sexual orientation. You acknowledge it. So I wonder if you're also not sending some vibes off that he's picking up on, that maybe you're not as gay groovy as you think. So in general, don't ask. Allow the person to come out when he or she is ready to. Number three on the list has to deal with transgender people and the confusion there around pronouns and gender identity. And again, straight and gay, and even in the gay community too, there's a lot of tripping up about pronouns and what hormones is he or she taking or what surgery is involved. And you know, that's nobody's business, and it has nothing to do with the answer to this. It's how you present. Now, that's easy to say, and that's sometimes, though, hard to do. And that's true for most of us. You know, we haven't had a lot of encounters with trans people, and so it takes a little bit of time to sort of reconfigure. And again, I think someone who's trans in that situation needs to continue to help us sort of come on board and just be clear about what the right thing to do is. And again, the right thing here is it's the respectful thing. It's about honoring the way that someone is presenting. That seems to be confusing because there's just more and more situations like this. And you know, the difference between sexual orientation and gender identity is still kind of coming into the mainstream. Sexual orientation being gay, straight, and other, lesbian, bi, and gender identity being more about masculine, feminine, male, female. And they really are different things. And but as I'm saying all that, I'm sort of going off the manners map and into other things.
If you've just tuned in, I'm Steve Pride, and we're talking with Stephen Petro, author of Stephen Petro's Complete Book of Gay and Lesbian Manners.
Number four is around sex etiquette and specifically around talking about STDs and HIV. And this is one that's more within the gay male community. I think one of the ways that this book pushes to new ground is that there's a whole chapter here on sex etiquette. And going back to what manners is, it's about our interactions, our social relations. And obviously, meeting up, hooking up, that's about interaction, social relations. So it's very purposeful in including that in this book. And the subtitle is, you know, in the bedroom and in the back room, because sex happens in all kinds of places. So in terms of talking about HIV and STDs, it can be an uncomfortable topic for some and for many because we're not that well-versed in it sometimes. And it seems not romantic. It seems this, it seems that. But I think it's important to remember that particularly the gay male community established the gold standard in sex etiquette back in the 80s by developing the principles for safer sex. And that really is a code of manners, using protection for yourself, protecting your partner, getting tested, knowing your HIV status. So the question within all of this is, when do I talk about it with someone new and how do I talk about it? And the answer is before you have sex. And so if you're going to have sex within 16 minutes of meeting each other, you need to find a way to get some basic information across to each other so that you can have the kind of safe sex that you need to have for your statuses. And if it's not for 3 months that you're going to go to bed, then you can take your time. But you need to have that. You don't need to make it a public health lecture. It can be humorous. But talking about it before you have sex, I think, is the wisest thing. If you're in a sex club where there are no words, everyone should assume that there's plenty of STDs around and protect themselves accordingly. Number five, it actually has to do with weddings. And it's really this question, are gay weddings different than straight weddings? And superficially, we can see many ways that they are. You have two brides, you have two grooms, you have the cake toppers that are same sex. And then there's best man, maid of honor, and all of that's mixed up because so many of our friends don't fall into the traditional roles. And my best friend may be a man, it may be a woman. They're called honor attendants. It's kind of the collective term, the umbrella term. And while some in our community really want to mime traditional straight weddings, there are many who are using the creativity and inventiveness that we have to add a different dimension, to bring music in, to kind of make it personal. So again, there can be a lot of superficial differences, But when you really get down to what a wedding is, whether it's straight or whether it's gay, it's about two people making a commitment. It's about two people loving each other. And that's the heart of what happens in these ceremonies. And that way, these ceremonies are very much the same. But there is a lot of confusion, and I'm going to start on the straight side of this. Mothers and fathers of their gay kids, they've usually kind of gotten to a place of total acceptance. And then now there is this sort of next stage of coming out, and it's a very public one, and they may be written up in the newspaper, and families may be drawn into it. So there's a little bit of sort of anxiety I'm seeing coming from them around that. And then about a lot of really tactical questions. Should they be expected to pay for the wedding of their son or their daughter? And in a way, it's kind of funny because a lot of the people who are going to be getting married in this first wave have been waiting and waiting for years. So let's just put it this way. They're not so young. And, you know, the idea of someone who's 35 or 50 or even older asking mom and dad to pay for their wedding seems a little bit off base. So primarily a responsibility that we'll be undertaking. And I think we're also learning there's a lot of sticker shock with the wedding. You know, the average cost is about $25,000. And so, you know, we've got this great new rite. You know, now there's some real sticker shock that goes along with that too. So that's kind of the overview. But then I hear from mothers, so there are going to be two mothers-in-law. How do we figure out what we wear? You know, and the answer there is it used to be just the bride's day. Well, now it's the two brides' day, and you don't want to compete with them. And, you know, I've heard from dads, if I've got a son and he's marrying his boyfriend, am I supposed to dance with one of them? Everything's up for discussion. And if you're not comfortable doing that, that's fine. And if you are, you know, two snaps for you. Then there's all this pressure that's being put on gay couples now. Very well-meaning. It comes from our gay friends and from our straight friends. When are you guys, when are you girls getting married? And it's as though we fought hard for the right to marry, the freedom to marry, but not the requirement to marry. And there are all kinds of reasons why particular couples will choose not to marry. Some of them financial. Some of them have to do with the tax code. Some of them have to do with their own notions of what marriage is and that it's a heterosexual institution that they don't want to partake of themselves, even though we believe everyone should have that choice. But there's a lot of pressure on couples right now about that.
Is there a common thread in your book that can guide us through all situations?
The premise for most manners books is make people comfortable. And that seems like a good enough premise, except when you get into difficult situations like someone heckling you, someone saying something anti-gay, where you need to speak up. And sometimes you need to make someone uncomfortable to do the right thing. So the underlying premise here is about respect and about civility. So if you respect yourself, if you respect your community and the larger community, that's point number one. And then also respecting those who are different from us and vice versa.
This has been part two of a two-part conversation with Stephen Petro, author of Stephen Petro's complete book of Gay and Lesbian Manners. Find more information online at gaymanners.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Janet Mason and Steve Pride contributed program material, and Christopher Gall and Chris Ann Eastwood added some holiday cheer. Dave Hall and Melanie Amaro performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible through the generosity of our listeners, thanks to all of you, and the support of stations like WERU Blue Hill Falls, Maine. It's never too late to log on to thiswayout.org and join the family. Come on and check out our social media links and more. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org, across Europe, Africa, the Middle East, and the Asia-Pacific region on the World Radio Network, and on more than 200 local stations around the world, including this community radio station. Please do stay tuned during your very...
Happy, 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 a happy...
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Against the Grain, he was the greatest English socialist historian of the 20th century, and his work still resonates today in how we understand class, social struggle, and history. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with labor historian Cal Winslow about the life, politics, and work of E.P. Thompson. That's coming right up. Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. While Howard Zinn is often credited with inventing history from below, one could make the argument that that accolade should be given to the brilliant British Marxist historian E.P. Thompson, whose Making of the English Working Class, published in 1963, revolutionized how people think about history and social change. Thompson was also an activist and polemicist of great note, playing a key role in the early New Left and later as a campaigner against nuclear weapons. The richness of his ideas and activism has been highlighted by a new collection of his writings titled E.P. Thompson and the Making of the New Left, edited by Thompson's former student, labor historian Cal Winslow. When I spoke with Cal Winslow recently, I started by asking him for his assessment of the significance of Thompson's contribution to how we think about history. This was his answer.
Well, I think he's known most of all for his practice of history from the bottom up. And in a sense, he's sometimes seen as kind of the founder of a whole school of history from the bottom up, which flourished in the late 60s and through the 1970s, although it's not really so popular today. And in regard to history from the bottom up, his emphasis on class and on the class struggle, and in that on the agency of ordinary people, of working class people, in making history, in making their own history, and in creating their own consciousness, I think stands out in my mind. So his great book, of course, that he's best known for, and I suppose will always be known for, is what they call in the academic world his magisterial, The Making of the English Working Class. And that's, in a sense, his attempt to recover the struggles, he calls them the tenacious struggles, revolutionary struggles of the British common people in the decades of the Industrial Revolution.
And I'll ask you more about that book, but I wanted to first ask you, when you talk about this history from the bottom up, what was E.P. Thompson reacting to in terms of how history had been written prior to that? What was he trying to make a break from?
Well, first of all, it was not an academic history, and he had no intention of writing an academic history, though, of course, academic history was there with its contributions of the great man in history or economic history or kinds of cultural history, which really meant the cultural practices of the upper classes. So, of course, he was trying to get away from mainstream history altogether. But in terms of writing about working people, he was also trying to break with mechanistic forms of history writing, with the idea that human history could somehow be seen as predetermined, or that it could be seen with the silence of the working people, that could be understood without the voices of the working people themselves. So he wanted to break from deterministic schools of historical writing, especially, I would say.
And when you say that, are you talking about determinism on the left? Clearly, the book was not just a work of history, although obviously it really remade how people thought of history, but it also was a political polemic.
Right. So, yes, it's a book of and for the left. He wrote it modestly, he said, really for he was a teacher of adult working class education in Northern England, and he wrote it first of all he thought for his students, and then for people, I suppose we'll get to this, involved in the first New Left, and for people involved in the CND, the Committee for Nuclear Disarmament. And I think he felt in some senses that he was helping to provide a platform, a political platform for those kinds of movements.
How do you understand Thompson to have viewed class itself as a category, something that obviously is central to the Marxist tradition, which Thompson can be broadly placed in, although I think you argue that over the course of his life, his own relationship to Marxism shifted a bit. But how did he understand class as a category, and how was that expressed in a book which is actually titled not The English Working Class, but The Making of the English Working Class?
Well, I think the primary notion is that the working class made itself, that it was there at its creation, and it made itself through a long history of conflict and struggle, and with its own cultural norms and ideas as well. So I guess that would be the main idea. He was very much opposed to the idea that you could measure class simply numerically, or that classes were the inevitable sort of products of historical forces, unwilling forces. So a common way of thinking about class earlier in the 20th century was the sort of the cotton mill plus the steam engine equaled the working class. And he rejected that kind of thinking altogether. He also rejected ideas of class coming from the Soviet Union, which were deterministic and involved the substitution of any number of other institutions and forces for working people themselves. So the party became the Communist Party came to be the voice of the class, not the working people themselves.
Why do you think that The Making of the English Working Class had such an impact on the left? I had a conversation not that long ago with an Iranian intellectual who was saying how profound and important this book was. And one would imagine that a book about British radical movements in the late 18th and early 19th century, labor movements, would be of limited interest to people elsewhere. Why do you think it had such impact?
Well, maybe I could just speak for myself. I know as a youngster, I was very interested in socialism, and I had some interest in working class movements. But I found nothing attractive at all in the official communist movement, the pro-Soviet movement. And I saw the American labor movement, and I, by extension, the Western labor movements, as extremely conservative. My own father was a labor organizer. And it was difficult, really, to place oneself in either, and I think not just myself, for a whole part of the radicalized youth of the 1960s, it was difficult to identify with either one of those traditions. We could go on about what was more about what was wrong with each tradition. But then along comes this really extraordinary book, which charts a path between social democracy in the West and Stalinism in the East, and orients one toward the rank and file of the working class movement, towards the spirit of revolt, of independence, and away from the sort of bureaucratic, deadening life of the official trade union movement, especially in the West.
It should be said, of course, that this book, The Making of the English Working Class, was published in 1963, and that E.P. Thompson had actually been a member of the Communist Party, one of the Poles that you're describing that the book kind of charted a path away from. What was his relationship to the Communist Party of Great Britain, and how did he end up breaking with it before he wrote this book?
Well, Edward Thompson, and I'll call him Edward, it's just what comes when I talk about him. Edward Thompson grew up in a family of liberal anti-imperialists. His parents were both missionaries, but missionaries in India and the Middle East who pretty much identified with the populations where they worked. And his father in particular was one of the best-known anti-imperialists in Britain, a supporter of Indian independence when Edward was growing up. And so he often liked to remind people that when something important seemed to be happening in his house, when his mother was really laying out a big spread for visitors, it was most likely to be someone who was just being released from prison, or someone who, especially typically an Indian nationalist or an Indian revolutionary, just being released from prison. So he grew up and in a bohemian neighborhood in Oxford. He grew up in that kind of milieu, and like many people in that period in the late 1930s, he was attracted to the Communist Party. In this, he followed his older brother Frank, who he idolized. But it was the period of the Spanish Civil War, and then the inability to win in Spain, and then with the rise of fascism and the overrunning of much of Europe by Hitler and his armies, he grew up in that kind of with that in the background, and so he followed his brother first into the Communist Party, which seemed to be an ideal place for people who wanted a better world and hated fascism and wanted to try to do something about it. He followed his brother into the Communist Party. He also followed his brother into the military, and he served out the several years of the war as a tank commander in the Italian campaign in particular. So he was not really so unusual for a leftist to become a communist. I don't know that he was ever a hardline Stalinist. He was an active member of the Communist Party in Northern England. However, he was on his district committee as a young man, and worked in what were sort of Soviet-oriented peace movements in the early 1950s when he began his historical writing.
And he was part of a group, and even more so, I think, his wife, Dorothy Thompson, a historian herself, they were part of a group of historians within the Communist Party that had some very illustrious fellow members, including Christopher Hill, Morris Dobb, the economic historian George Roudet, and Eric Hobsbawm. How important do you think that kind of circle, that milieu, was for his shaping of his notions of history from the bottom up?
Well, by all accounts, it was extraordinarily important. As you've mentioned, his wife, Dorothy, who went on to become one of the leading historians of the Chartist movement, was probably more active in the Communist Historians group than Edward was. But he was he participated as well. And so, yes, it was a group of Marxist intellectuals, but one that seemed apparently inspired by its sort of leader and organizer, Donna Tour. It was a group of Marxist intellectuals who seemed to be very flexible in their Marxism, who were willing to challenge many of the stereotypical left-wing or hackneyed left-wing positions. And I think if the question how influential, is extremely influential. And I might add one thing here, Sasha, if you don't mind. It was a collective project, the Communist Historians Group, even though the people themselves were engaged in many different areas of history. They worked together. They shared their work. And they built upon each other's work so that, just to give you one example, so that it one criticism of the making of the English Working Class, his book, was that it didn't stress economic structures as much as it should have. And Edward actually responded by saying, well, to a degree, he agreed with that, but he thought that it was Eric Hobsbawm who really was covering that subject, and he needed not go over it all again. Well, rightly or wrongly, it certainly was an indication of his idea that intellectual work should be in a collective enterprise, and he carried that into his teaching, and certainly that was one of the things that all of his students got from him, that work was to be shared and built upon. And I think that was one of the things that Donna Tour taught them.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Cal Winslow about the life and work of the great British Marxist socialist historian E.P. Thompson. Cal Winslow studied with Thompson and co-authored with him Albion's Fatal Tree. He's the editor of E.P. Thompson and the Making of the New Left, which is published by Monthly Review Press. So how did Thompson end up breaking with the Communist Party of Great Britain, a place which in many ways had been an intellectual home for him?
Well, I'm sure you know this very well, Sasha. The background is that there was an international crisis in the communist movement in the 1950s, in the middle of the 1950s, and a crisis that affected people all over the world. In England, where Edward was, the first thing was the famous Khrushchev speech, where he detailed what came to be known as Stalin's crimes in the history of his dictatorship of the Soviet Union. That happened early in 1956. Then later in the year, November, I think it was, there was a revolt of workers and students in Hungary and Budapest in particular. And the revolt was not an anti-communist revolt, I should add. Revolt which threw up, amongst other things, workers' councils, but it was a revolt which was savagely repressed. The whole world got to see. There was television by then, Soviet tanks rolling into Budapest. That was a shock and a horror for many communist members around the world. At the same time, however, Colonel Nasser in Egypt, the nationalist leader in Egypt, nationalized the Suez Canal, which led to another kind of crisis. And the British and the French, along with the Israelis, conspired to invade the canal zone in an attempt to take the Suez Canal back from the Egyptians. The whole thing became a nightmare for the British. The Americans wouldn't back them up and basically ordered them to retreat. But it was quite a shock. Again, the war was – the Second World War was still in everyone's mind, and the idea that it was fought to make the world a better place. And here was the same old thing happening, the British and the French trying to revamp empire. So those two crises together – created a great exodus from the Communist Party, but also reemphasized the fact that there had to be a real socialist, anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist left in the West, that it would not do if a retreat from communism, official communism, meant a disappearance of the left altogether. So Thompson, Edward Thompson, and Dorothy Thompson and their comrades, they decided that what they had to do was to try to defend what they thought was best in the small c communist tradition, and to find a way between the West and the Soviet Union to recreate socialism. To have a socialist renewal based on a non-aligned policy, neither East nor West.
And this attempt to try and create another socialist project out of the rubble, really, of what you've just described, is the meat of this collection that you have edited, E.P. Thompson and the Making of the New Left, essays that focus on the period from the mid-50s until the early 60s. And central to that project was the making, if you will, of a new left in Britain in the late 50s in reaction to the bankrupt old left. Who were involved in this project, and what was it, generally speaking?
Intellectually, I guess, politically, there were two groups. There was the group that Edward and Dorothy Thompson were part of. And that was the group of ex-communists, people who had just left the Communist Party. And their base was and maybe we can come back to that. Their base was essentially in the industrial north of England. They lived in Yorkshire, in the heavily industrialized part of England, the West Riding of Yorkshire. And so the movement there was, as the area was a highly working class movement with strong roots in the mills and the mines and in the labor movement there. So that was one part. They I could put this in now. They created there first a sort of underground journal inside the Communist Party called the Reasoner. And then a new journal, once they were out of the Communist Party, called the New Reasoner. They were joined by a group of young intellectuals, especially a group whose base was at Oxford, at the university and in the colleges at Oxford, who sort of simultaneously and independently put out another journal called the Universities and Left Review. And these were young intellectuals who were very interested in the new circumstances of the 1950s, of the changes in culture in Britain, of the development of what then, it seems odd now, but what then was called affluence and the beginning of a consumer sort of society. They were interested in all that, but they were Marxists as well and revolutionaries as well. And the two groups in 1957 and 58 came together, and they formed what later came to be known as the New Left, and we sometimes call it the First New Left so that we don't confuse it with what happened in the middle and late 60s. And they formed that, and they tried to do all sorts of things, really. But what stood out about them, I think, was that they were open, free discussion was allowed and encouraged, debate was championed. Anything could be talked about. And while they maintained a focus on class and on the structures of the British society, they weren't restricted to that alone. One of the things they did was to start a group of sort of local organizations. They came to be called left clubs, and these flourished for a couple of years all over Britain. And they were independent, non-sectarian, left-wing organizations, which were both educational and discussional and activist. Some of the people in this group, some of the people in the first group, the New Reasoner group, included the people in the historians group that you asked me about earlier. In the second group were some very remarkable people, including the cultural historian Stuart Hall, who listeners may know of. He wasn't the only one, of course. Ralph Samuel became a well-known historian, especially in the late 60s. Peter Sedgwick was a psychoanalyst who was interested in left-wing politics at the time.
Was there a sense at that moment of sort of new possibilities opening up for forging a new left, so to speak? And what happened with that first effort?
Well, these things, Sasha, it's difficult looking back on it to know quite how to answer your question. I think they were very optimistic at first. It seemed like there really was a large opening for a new kind of movement. There were a new generation coming into activism in Britain, especially in the CND, again, the Committee for Nuclear Disarmament. In 1957, the British government decided to build its own bomb, to have its own nuclear deterrent. And this led to a new kind of mass movement, really, in Britain, probably a new kind of mass movement for almost any place, although it was influenced by the civil rights movement in the United States, the Southern Civil Rights Movement, and came to share many of the sorts of tactics used by the civil rights movement. But the CND brought hundreds of thousands of people, mostly young people, into political activity, into great marches and sit-down strikes and demonstrations. And the new left clubs sort of had a symbiotic relationship with the CND. They weren't by any means its leaders, but they were an active core that pushed the CND to the left, that pushed it toward independence, toward non-aligned positions. And in those days, it was still the case that many of the peace movements were essentially aligned with the Soviet Union, and the single emphasis was American and Western imperialism. And then, of course, there were peace groups in the West that were essentially pro-Western. The Americans for Democratic Action in this country was nominally for peace, but was anti-communist. So the new left clubs pushed in that kind of a direction. They pushed for activity from below. They were not in favor of trying to capture the leadership of the CND, nor were they in favor of trying to capture the leadership of the labor movement. They saw their role as being activists, being participants, being non-sectarian, and trying to help guide those organizations and the new people coming into the movement, helping to guide them in what they consider to be a healthy way, and in that to build a genuine alternative. And they were, I think they were hugely successful for a short period of time. But, you know, like lots of things that happened on the left, it was a short period of time. By the beginning of the 1960s, CND began to decline, and the left clubs began to decline along with it. I think there were some disputes, typical kind of disputes for British left history, that took place. What about one's attitude toward the Labour Party? To be in the Labour Party, to be out of the Labour Party, does it make any difference? The new left clubs were not well financed. It was very difficult for them to maintain their publications. The two journals had merged to become the New Left Review, which still exists, interestingly, today. So all sorts of problems really overtook them, and in turn, of course, it was very discouraging for those people who had quite high hopes in 1957, 58, 59, 60.
Sure, and then, of course, the left in Britain, as similarly to the left in the United States, took on a particular different kind of politics in the 1960s going into the 1970s, and Edward Thompson found himself in debate with those people who carried the New Left Review forward, including the very young Perry Anderson and Robin Blackburn. And in one of his essays included in the collection E.P. Thompson and the Making of the New Left, Thompson lays out some of his criticisms about this, the form that part of the New Left in Britain was taking. That essay is Where We Are Now. So I wonder if you could comment on the criticisms that he leveled at the time, and to what degree they were borne out as that period unfolded.
Well, that's a very big question, and it still is, deeply controversial, all the issues that were talked about then. So I guess I could only say that the new group, they called themselves the team, some quite remarkable people, Perry Anderson, Robin Blackburn, Tariq Ali came on, other people of that generation, you know, very highly intellectual individuals. They decided that the best thing for the New Left Review, which they captured, Edward would have said, in 1963, was to become a sort of voice of new intellectual currents, left-wing intellectual currents, primarily from the continent and primarily from France. And while many of these contributions were important and lasting, they came to utterly dominate the pages of the New Left Review. And whereas the earlier New Left Review had included not just highly intellectual pieces, but reviews and poetry and illustrations and reports of activity and reports of the everyday issues of the time, all of those were left behind by the new team. And I would have to say it looks like Edward was right, that they pretty much turned their back entirely on the British working class, on the ordinary people of the country that they lived in. Other particular problems with some of the ideas that became current were, for an obvious one, the development of what we later called third worldism, and the idea that the primary issues facing humanity were involved the conflict between the metropolitan countries and the Third World, and the idea that the issues of socialism and human emancipation would be settled not in the metropolitan countries at all, but in the Third World. Interest in China, interest in guerrilla movements, these kinds of things came to dominate new left thinking in many parts of the West. So Third Worldism was one thing. Other secondary issues, we might say, would be the tendency toward elitism in the new movements. New ideas about vanguards and leadership and so forth emerged. And Thompson was very much anti-elitist, anti-hierarchical. He was very skeptical in general about organization, trade union organization, the Labor Party, and left-wing organization, partially as a result of his experience in the Communist Party. So there was a critique of new forms of elitism, and also other things that came along. The celebration of violence, I think, abhorred him. He himself felt that he had some understanding of violence. He, as I said earlier, he was a veteran of World War II. He'd been a tank commander and seen many of his comrades killed and many people on the other sides killed in the very bloody battles of central Italy. So he was very much out of sympathy with the idea that power, political power flows from the barrel of a gun, and that militaristic organizations could lead to anything very positive. There are more things, as you could probably guess. I tend to be very much in sympathy with his ideas. I think that the new left in this country certainly had a third world problem, still does. And I think that unfortunate cults of violence developed a total misunderstanding of violence and of the forces of the balance of forces in society developed. And, of course, new ideas about vanguards and the place of vanguards in movements. All of those things were issues that he was concerned about. But more than anything else, I suppose, he felt that the abandoning of the English people by the new editors was tragically mistaken, and he urged them to rethink what they were doing. He said at one point, "Put your boots on and go out amongst the ordinary people and have some humility in the face of their lives and their experiences." And I think that was good advice. I think it would be good advice for us, all of us, today. Of course, that advice wasn't taken, not by the new left, anyway.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. Today we're talking about the ideas and legacy of the great British socialist historian E.P. Thompson. I'm joined by his former student, Cal Winslow, who has recently put together a collection of Thompson's essays titled E.P. Thompson and the Making of the New Left. That's published by Monthly Review Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Cal Winslow is fellow in environmental history at UC Berkeley's Geography Department, and he's the director of the Mendocino Institute. One of the polemics that Thompson was involved in, one of the exchanges coming out of the 60s, in fact, in the 1970s, was an exchange with the French Marxist philosopher Louis Althusser, who in many ways embodies the kind of continental ideas that the New Left Review championed. This exchange, Thompson published his half in a book called The Poverty of Theory. To what degree was the debate with Althusser a political intervention about the politics of that time?
Well, I think it was a debate about many of the things which were central to Edwards' thinking throughout his entire life. And I don't know myself if it's so important, really, in terms of the various kinds of contributions that Edward made. And there are many people who think that really he sort of was sidetracked by this debate. But as best as I understand it, it was a debate against structuralism and the idea that the understanding of society came along with the understanding of the structures of society. And that going back to what we talked about earlier, that in structuralism, one found a new determinism. And for Edward, once again, human activity, human moral choice was excluded from this way of thinking, from this way of understanding what might lead to a better world. So he was very bothered by the influence of Althusser and this new structuralism, this new kind of determinism, and what he felt was the elitism involved in it. But also because it simply excluded the ideas of values, of socialist values. What is socialism all about? What do socialists believe in? And it excluded agency, the idea that people make their own history, of course, not in the circumstances they choose, but that it excluded all of that. And so he put his pen to paper and did what he did in many on many occasions, and he wrote a long polemical response to Althusser. I don't know, you know, Althusser himself may well be known for having murdered his wife. I don't know, you know, how important he is now or how important he will be in the future. And we have, I guess, new kinds of determinisms today. But what I would take out of the debate would be the themes that Edward built upon, that he had been speaking about, writing about, campaigning about all his life.
Edward Thompson remains known as a pioneering historian, someone who, even for his opponents, even for people on the right, someone who must be taken seriously. And yet, despite that, let's call it academic success, he was also someone who was deeply convinced of the importance of worker education. Can you tell us about that importance in his life and how it translated into action?
Well, I think we have to say here that it's part of what influenced him as a member of the communist movement, which was embedded in the working class of the North and the working classes of the West and North America at the time. I think that he carried class ideas and politics out of that movement, even though he changed a lot. And he became like a whole generation of British socialist educators. He became part of what was called a movement then, a workers' education movement. And what's interesting about this movement was that it took people who'd probably left schooling in their early teens, probably had a bad experience in education, and had worked of course, the Northern England was overwhelmingly comprised of manual workers and their families. It addressed the interest in education of these people, and but on a completely voluntary basis, so that an individual could sign up for a course, say on literature or on politics or history, or they could sign up for a course and take typically 2 terms a year. And they would meet in a town in one of the industrial centers of the North. They would meet in the back room of a library or in a community hall or in someone's living room, and they would read and discuss and write about their topic, and their teacher would be called a tutor, and the tutor was kind of an itinerant educator. Really, they would travel around the area of the catchment area of their program, and meet with these people. So typically, Edward would be teaching three or four nights a week, traveling all over the heavily populated West Riding of Yorkshire, and talk to people. His first interest was literature at this time. As a very young man, he mainly taught literature, but he would talk to them about literature, about Shakespeare and Wordsworth and whatever else they might be interested in. But he also talked to them about themselves and about their lives and about their history and about the history of the generations before them in this part of the world, the place where the Industrial Revolution in many ways took off. So he looked for connections to the Luddites, the machine breakers of the 18th century, and to the Chartist movement and to the utopian socialists of the 19th century. And he tried to learn from these people about traditions such as these. He felt that the teacher always had as much to learn from the student as to teach the student. And he tried in doing that to instill in them a respect for that tradition and to get them to think about how to carry it on. So he was a great believer in working class education, but his devotion was partially his devotion to a socialist renewal and to getting away from what he and others called all the horribleness that had gone before the war, and make something of the high hopes that people felt when the war was finally over. So in that sense, he was a great advocate of education, but he was also an activist, and he hoped that his students would become participants in the new movements of the 1950s, and of course, many of them did.
You studied with Edward Thompson in the 1970s, and I wonder if you could tell us about springing from your discussion of the centrality of workers' education for Thompson, if you could tell us about his critique of the university, which I guess in some ways one could see as a pair.
Yeah, he was always skeptical about the academy in Britain. He'd of course, had gone to Cambridge himself, although he had no advanced degrees and he'd never been part of any prestigious institution. He'd always been skeptical. And for 17 years, from 1948 to 1965, he taught in these circumstances that I've been describing. And I didn't say much about place, but of course, Northern England, he lived there. His family grew up there. He worked with people there. So place was important to him. In 1965, it's not important really now why he decided, his family decided to try a position in a university. A new university was opened up along with an expansion of British education called Warwick University in the West Midlands. And he took a position that was offered to him as director of a Center for the Study of Social History. And the university was quite small. The number of students, especially PhD students, was quite small, and only a few of us there in the early years. He set up a really remarkable a program. I don't know if you want to talk about that or not, but it was a program which really was a kind of collective, as I mentioned earlier. He brought Donator's ideas about collective educational work to his center. And the center became a center not just for the students at the university, but for intellectuals, for left-wing intellectuals, for trade union activists, for early feminists, for anti-war activists all over the country. And so as a student there, we were introduced to a whole world of intellectual life and political activity and cultural critique. And it was really quite marvelous. And I was very lucky to be able to be part of what he inspired, I guess, although he wasn't solely responsible for it, the crime group. That is a group of people, including himself and several others, who took upon ourselves a study of the role of crime, of criminal activity in 18th century English society. And what we were looking for early aspects of the class struggle, his great interest. And we did that by looking into legal records, which had previously not been paid attention to by social historians. And so we looked at the dying words of criminals. We looked at the records of fugitives. I studied smuggling. We studied many kinds of crime, and we put out the book you mentioned, Albion's Fatal Tree. But the most important thing about it was that it was a collective work, but an interesting kind of collective work, because we all didn't have to agree with each other. In fact, we didn't all agree with each other, and any reader will be able to see that. But we shared our work, we critiqued our work, and we ultimately put out the book together. So that was really a kind of an extraordinary experience for me. Some listeners may have heard of Sheila Rowbotham. She came through in 1968 and 69, talking in some of her first meetings about women workers and early feminism. Bernadette Devlin came through several times. She was the Irish revolutionary who became the first the youngest member of the British Parliament ever. Lawrence Daly, a leader of the Scottish Miners. I mean, it was just really a fantastic experience. At the very same time that we were experiencing all of this and being, I must say, inspired, and it was not by accident at all that a whole group of us, his students, went into working class adult education when we were finished with graduate school. In the midst of all this, however, the university, Warwick University itself, was developing as one of the universities in Britain with the closest ties to industry. And this came out when, during a sit-in, an occupation of the registry at the university, we students discovered files that showed us that the university was having secret meetings with industrialists, that they were keeping files on political activists, that they were attempting to keep political activists from being accepted to the university, that they were trying to victimize political activists at the university. And all of this not totally out in the open, but sort of shamelessly. The Coventry, which is where Warwick University is, was still then considered to be the Detroit, the little Detroit of Britain. It was the center of the motor car industry. And, lo and behold, we found the business school, being heavily funded, and the Center for Social History not being funded. But as a result of the sit-in and the finding of the files and the publication of the files, Edward threw himself into basically an exposure of the business university, or sometimes he called it the Mid-Atlantic University. And part of his work can be found in Warwick University Limited, a book that was published about the struggle at Warwick, and a new edition was put out just last year, Warwick University Limited. In that, Edward lays out some of his ideas about education. You won't be surprised to hear that he didn't think that the best education took place in the elite universities, and not just because of what happened in the file struggle. Edward was to leave the university in 1970-71 and become an independent writer, speaker, and political activist.
Unfortunately, we are utterly out of time. Cal, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us.
Sasha, my pleasure.
Cal Winslow is the editor of the recently published book E.P. Thompson and the Making of the New Left. That's published by Monthly Review Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Cal studied with Thompson and is fellow in environmental history at UC Berkeley's Geography Department. He's also the director of the Mendocino Institute. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thank you so much for joining us. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Our intern is Ian Scullion. Our engineer is Wesley Burton. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
Since the attacks in Paris, which killed fewer than four other attacks that same week, but they weren't white, they don't count, the FBI has stepped up its surveillance over possible threats here in the United States. I saw on the corporate news, brought to us by Disney, a corporation named after a guy who supported Hitler, that the FBI currently has 90 people in the United States under constant watch. When I saw that, I thought that was just another tidbit of propaganda, you know, just some random fictional factoid to make people feel relatively safe and extremely endangered all at the same time. I didn't think the FBI was really keeping people under constant watch. And then I woke up this morning and I found this stranger in my cell sitting at the desk. He was wearing a shirt and tie and had his sport coat draped over the back of the plastic chair he was sitting in. I noted that he had helped himself to a cup of my coffee. At first, I thought, maybe this guy was my Secret Service protection since I'm running for president. But no, he's the FBI agent assigned to me. He told me to act like he wasn't there, but he was staring at me as I attempted to use the toilet, and I really can't use the toilet under pressure. The agent suggested that I run the sink water, and that worked. So I guess that proves that this guy has a lot of experience creeping people out and staring at them while they your tax dollars at work, sports fans. He followed me to the chow hall at breakfast and stared at me from the next table as I ate my scrambled eggs. He took notes on a flip-open notebook he keeps in his shirt pocket. Nobody wanted to sit with me at breakfast. Go figure. So from there, I went over to the library. Dude followed me around as I handed other prisoners books. At count time, when I returned to my cell, I read something that friends sent me proposing Black December. As I read, the FBI agent used my remote and flipped through the channels in my TV and spent the time watching Jerry Springer. From what I gather, the scenario was that some guy was cheating on the mother of his child with an exotic dancer. The mother of his child and the exotic dancer fought each other, and then the mother of his child forgave him and took him back. The FBI agent sure drinks a lot of coffee. I can't really afford this. At shift change, another agent took over. The second agent spends most of his shift talking on the phone with his girlfriend, his feet propped up on my locker box, yet holes in his socks. Apparently, the FBI doesn't pay like it used to. I wonder if the other 89 people on the watch list are having similar experiences. I sure hope the Islamic State stops killing white people so this nonsense can die down and I can get rid of this intense surveillance. The second shift agent's feet stink up my cell. So, just before the grand finale of Dancing with the Stars, the third shift agent came on. He's an older guy. He was rooting for Nick, the former Backstreet Boy, and I was rooting for Bindi, the daughter of that Australian wilderness guy who got killed by a stingray. The agent clearly didn't know his ballroom dance. I had to explain the difference between Argentine tango and the Paso Doble. I showed him a few things. His frame was sloppy. I had to leave. Where are they finding these agents? Anyhow, the guy was chain-smoking while I tried to sleep, and I had to leave my cell window open to get rid of the smoke. So, look, I have no privacy at all. These wackos even watch me in the shower while I take a while I sleep. It appears this intense surveillance is going to continue throughout the holidays, or maybe even longer if the Islamic State continues to kill white people on the European continent. Anyhow, just so you know, when the FBI says they're closely monitoring 90 of the most serious threats to national security, they're not kidding. And yet, I'm still sneaking out my radio segments through the mail. Go figure. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from somewhere inside the Ohio torture complex. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.